was Mama Monster. That's how stupid. I can't help it.
This. I'm gonna keep the recording until you say it. So.
Okay, wait a minute. I gotta compose.
You've gotta get through it, or we're never gonna be able to do this.
I have to compose myself. Wait a minute.
Jesus. But no, happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
I love you.
I love you,
you
too.
You are the best.
Thank you very
now,
much.
Now get out of here. I have a show to do.
Hey, this is Mama Monster, and you're listening to the Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered!
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have 2 more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster? Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
This is your Mother's Day edition of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, May 9th, 2021. I am the Solo Monster. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there listening. Now through May 24th, you've got, let's see, how many weeks is that? Only a few weeks left to take advantage of the Amazon Music offer. You can get 3 free months of Amazon Music when you use our link. That's getamazonmusic.com/Solo Monster. That is the link to use. And also, one last reminder here, that Drew McIntyre has a brand new book out called A Chosen Destiny, My Story. You can listen to it in his own words using our Audible trial link. Get it for free. audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Either of those links, you'll get something free. You help out the podcast. If you'd like to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. Want to say thank you this week to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, Big Bear, Brian Becerra, Killshot, Keith Hart, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soap, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Ostentatious Alan Carter, the Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, John Raging Mad Riffle, the Lake George Lunatic, Bobby Blanchard, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, Dastardly Derek Smith, the Alabama Assassin, Chris Young, and the Elite, Edward Vary, first time donator to the podcast, so welcome to Edward. Also, a few more shout outs here. I got to shout out Julian Cannon, who I know many of you know from the Facebook group. He and his lovely lady, Fidelina, are going to be parents this October to a baby boy. So congratulations to the happy couple. I am very happy for the both of you. October's a good month. There's just something about October that I like. Can't quite put my finger on it. It's not just Halloween. It's a good month. Break the Apocalypse. There's a podcast you may or may not have heard of before. There is a 4-hour special edition of the Break the Apocalypse podcast divided into 2 parts, celebrating John Draper's 50th birthday with John, Shaw, and Bisho Bryan. And a little birdie told me there may have been a Solo Monster cameo in there. Happy birthday to John. I hope you had a blast on your big day. You deserve it. Don't get too used to it, though. At your age, your back will be going out more than you will. But new episodes drop every Friday. You can find the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Spreaker, and all major platforms. And they have a Patreon as well. If you'd like to show your support that way, just type in Break the Apocalypse. And finally, there is an Indiegogo campaign that I want you all to check out for a new independent film called Sunshine Girl. It is based on the real-life story of Tina McLaughlin, written by her husband, Craig. Tina is challenged in her life many times, including by cancer. In her case, Hodgkin's lymphoma at age 13, and then breast cancer at age 44. They have a $50,000 budget for the film, and they are looking to fundraise at least 30% of that. There's also a scene in the movie that features part of my mother's children's book, a little reading from the book, which is very nice of them to do. If you would like to read more about the film, or maybe even donate, send a little support their way, you may do so by visiting Indiegogo.com and typing Sunshine Girl in the search field. It'll be the first campaign that comes up. Or you can visit igg.me/@, that's the word at, A-T, /Sunshine Girl. And shout out to Craig. I know he's been putting a lot of time and work into that project now for many months, and very cool to see it moving along and coming to fruition. So congrats to him on that. We got a lot of documentary talk this week. I got a lot of thoughts on some of the documentary specials. Very polarizing Macho Man Randy Savage biography on A&E from last weekend. And The Two Dudes with Attitudes, Untold, on the WWE Network. My Dark Side of the Ring review for the Brian Pillman episode, the double episode that aired on Vice this past Thursday. That was the kickoff to Season 3 of Dark Side of the Ring. I'm going to keep that separate. I'm just not going to have time to squeeze it in here on the main show. So that should be up on YouTube in the next, I'd say in the next day or two. So keep an eye out for that. But first, we got news. 7 more wrestlers in New Japan have tested positive for COVID-19. Here is the statement the company issued late last night. As a result of PCR testing conducted across the roster following the May 4th Wrestling Dontaku event in Fukuoka, New Japan has learned of 7 positive tests for COVID-19. As previously reported, 2 wrestlers who presented with a fever on the day of the May 4th event were immediately tested in accordance with protocols, with the tests returning positive. In light of this news, all those who had close contact with the infected parties, in addition to every wrestler on the roster, received PCR tests, with a further 7 wrestlers testing positive. All those who tested positive are experiencing mild symptoms or are asymptomatic. According to protocols and under medical advice, all are isolating and receiving appropriate treatment. New Japan deeply apologizes for the concern caused to fans and personnel and asks for your understanding. You know, it's a tough thing that's going on in Japan right now. It seemed for a while there like they were kind of turning the corner and they had a good handle on things. From what I understand, I know the vaccine rollout over there has been something of a disaster. They just extended its state of emergency in Tokyo and Osaka through May 31st after yet another wave of new infections. And this is a country that's due to host the Olympics in less than 3 months. July 23rd is when they're supposed to begin. They already postponed it from last year, and they can't delay it again because they have other events scheduled for next year. There's the Winter Games, I think, in China next year. I think it's only a matter of time before they make the decision to cancel rather than just try to shoehorn it in there no matter what. I think that's kind of dumb. But I suspect that we'll get a decision one way or the other sometime in the next couple of weeks, since it's coming up pretty fast. You know, Wrestling Dontaku Day 2, I checked out the main event. Will Ospreay against Shingo Takagi, and I had to at least watch this match. I didn't get to see anything else yet, but I wanted to make sure I watched that match, even though it was 40 minutes long. So I knew that going in, it was going to be a long match. But that was my match of the year 2 years ago. I think it was the finals and the Super Juniors. They had an unbelievable match. These two just work so well together. It's so much fun to watch these two in the ring. And I thought, well, gotta watch this match. I mean, if they were match of the year 2 years ago, could they match that? Could they live up to that? This one's going to be in the conversation. This one is definitely going to be in the conversation at year's end for match of the year. Kevin Kelly, when it was over, called it the best wrestling match that he has ever called. And think of the matches that he has called for New Japan in the years that he has been there. Think of all the classics that this man has called, has been ringside for. That is the highest of praise. And having watched it, I don't know that I would disagree. I still think it's a little early for me to sit here and think, okay, is this better than Omega Okada and some of the Okada Tanahashi matches and... you know, I don't know. I'd have to let some time go by for that. But this is definitely up there. They had a hell of a match. It started out, you know, a little slow. They could have shaved off a few minutes. But It picked up. It was just back and forth right up until the very end. Osprey retains after the Hidden Blade and the Stormbreaker. Don't know when his match now is going to be with Okada, given the situation in Japan and the events I think that were scheduled for later this month are now canceled or at least postponed. So who knows when he'll defend that title next, but an incredible match. These two lived up to the expectations that I had for going in. AEW, Blood and Guts, on Wednesday night was number one for the night on all of cable television for the first time in the show's history in the coveted 18 to 49 demo. And by a pretty wide margin. Raw, you know, as bad as it is, it pretty much does that almost every week. But it's the first time that AEW has been able to do it in its history. It was not their biggest demo ever. It was the second biggest demo ever, but it was the first time they landed in the number one spot. And TNT has to be elated with that. But I thought the overall audience would be higher. They were back over a million viewers. They were up from 889,000 the week before. But only at 1.09 million. I thought going in, you know, anything under 1.3 for a heavily promoted show like this would be disappointing. But there were a few people in the live chat on Wednesday night during the post-show stream when I asked for people's predictions saying, oh, 1.7 million. They're going to do 1.9 million. I hope they don't drug test at your place of employment. You might want to call out sick that day. There was never any chance of that happening. None. None. I would have grown whiskers and shit in the litter box if that were the case. Not going to happen. But it is nice to be optimistic. Now, let's talk just a little bit here about this Blood and Guts match, because there was a lot of debate, and there was a lot of, not even controversy, it was a very polarizing match, very polarizing finish or post-match bump. Right, with the MJF Chris Jericho thing. First of all, loved the live crowd on Wednesday night. When that match got going, man, that crowd, they only had about 1,600 people in the building. I thought it was a little bit more than that. But, man, you would think that place was packed. You would think that they were at full capacity. These people were amped up, and no, it wasn't fake crowd noise. I heard from a whole bunch of people, actually, who were in Jacksonville for the show. These people were amped up, and it made a world of difference. It was a bloody affair. It was actually closer to the original War Games matches, not just based on the rules that they use and the top on the cage, but, you know, even more so than the ones in NXT. Just, you know, the brutality of it and the blood and, you know, was there too much blood? Probably. I don't know that every fucking person had to bleed, but, or it felt like almost every person bled. The ad breaks did hurt, but look, they're a necessary evil. You know, when you put a match like this on television and not on pay-per-view, it's the same problem that people had with the Iron Man match with Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar on SmackDown back in 2003. You know, and that was a longer match. So you're kind of getting into it and all of a sudden, oh, we got to go to commercial. And it does kind of take you out of it. But it was the right outcome. The heels had to go over here. They're the newer faction. They're the newer group. They had to be established in a dominant way. They needed this win more than the Inner Circle did. And the Pinnacle came out with the win. I thought that the finish going in, my prediction had been that Chris Jericho would actually surrender because the Pinnacle was about to do something really evil to Sammy Guevara. And in fact, it was just the opposite, where you could hear, you know, they were outside the cage. They made their way up to the top, which, you know, weird, given the fact that you had a top on the cage. Why do they need to leave the cage? But we have MJF and Chris Jericho on top, on the roof of the cage. And MJF is threatening to throw Jericho off to his death. And down below, you can hear Sammy Guevara surrender. Because MJF is saying, if you don't surrender, I'm going to throw him off. And so Sammy Guevara is the one who actually gave up for his team. And that gave the Pinnacle the win. And of course, MJF being the prick that he is, he pushed him off anyway. And Jericho took about a 10-foot bump down onto some mattresses down below that were disguised to look like a metal grate, but very clearly they were not. Now, I want to get into this here. Now, I said this during my review. This is nothing new. I tweeted about it the other day, too. But I made this clear the night of the show. to anybody who watched and anybody who listened on the download, I made it very clear, I was very specific in what my criticism was of this finish. Because I have seen, as I said on Twitter, I saw so many absolutely horrendous takes the morning after from a lot of people. And it's one thing to see them from random eggs with no avatar on Twitter. But I saw people with blue checks next to their name saying some of the dumbest shit that I have seen in a very long time. Criticizing the criticisms that people had of the finish to that show and the big bump at the very end, saying, oh my God, I can't believe, did all these people expect Chris Jericho to fall on actual concrete? Did they really think he was going to die? No, you fucking moron. No, actually, that's not what people were hoping. That's not what people were expecting. And the thing about it is that these people know better. These are people in some cases, and I'm not going to name names, but these are people in some cases who should know better. And they just spewed some of the dumbest takes that I have seen. Absolutely no one of note, was arguing this. This was the ultimate straw man argument that I saw constantly up and down my timeline the morning after this Blood and Guts show. I actually explained in great detail how I would have shot that final scene. My criticism had everything to do with the way it was shot and the production of it. Yes, we have seen countless times in AEW, we have seen countless times in WWE, and probably other promotions as well, but WWE has done it a whole bunch over the years, where somebody will fall, or somebody will be pushed onto a giant box or a giant crash pad. Right? We've seen this time and time again, and sometimes the way it's shot, it looks terrible. But then other times, if you think about some of those early Shane McMahon bumps, for example, Shane McMahon took one of the scariest bumps I've ever seen. I mean, I'm afraid of heights anyway. But it was SummerSlam, I want to say back in 2000, right? It was him and Steve Blackman. I think that was the year they had their match. And they were scaling the truss or whatever by the entranceway. And Shane had to be, I mean, legitimately every bit of 40 feet, right? 40 or 50 feet in the air. And Blackman is on one side. He's got a kendo stick in his hand. Shane has his back turned to where he was going to fall. And Blackman whacks him with the kendo stick. And Shane just takes this dive. He just falls backwards and falls off. And is kind of like floating through the air. I cannot ever imagine doing that. If I did that with a harness, I would still shit myself. Okay, this guy's got brass balls taking bumps like that. But I remember the way that that was shot. And I remember Shane falling backwards and they kind of panned out and they had this wide shot. And all you saw was Shane off in the distance falling backwards and you heard a loud crash. I don't remember them zooming in. Maybe on the replay they did, but I remember them zooming in on it as he was falling. The way it was shot, it actually looked pretty cool. Right? Other times, not so much. So, no, this is nothing new. It's all the people doing the whataboutism. Oh, what about WWE? They do it all the time. These people are fucking morons too. Yes, we've seen this countless times before, and guess what? In those situations, I didn't want to see those people fall to the concrete either. You know why? Because I'm not a deranged psychopath. It's all in the way that it's shot. My suggestion would have been, if that was going to be the final kind of parting shot of the show, yeah, I keep saying the finish. I mean, technically the finish came before that. This was not technically the finish of the match, but when people say the finish, I think you know kind of what they're talking about. But what they did here was, after MJF sent Jericho off the cage, plummeting down to his death, he was up on top of that cage what felt like forever. They were stalling for time. They still had time left to kill on the broadcast. So he was just kind of standing around on top doing a whole lot of nothing. But then they zoomed in on MJF, and he looked down at Jericho, and he said, "Thank you." Because if you remember, before the Blood and Guts match, he said that he was going to take Jericho's spot, and then he was going to thank him for it. And that's what he did. He said, "Thank you." Well, what I would have done is I would have had him up on top with Jericho, and you could do the exact same finish. He's threatening to throw him off. Sammy says, "No, we surrender," right? They sacrifice the win to save their leader. And MJF says, "Okay," he got what he wanted, right? He got a big smile on his face. He's helping Jericho, who's all groggy. He's helping Jericho up to his feet. He's got his hand on his shoulder. And the camera zooms in real close. And he says to Jericho, Chris, thank you. And then with that comes the push. And then he shoves Jericho off. And then, instead of shooting it as Jericho is falling and getting a zoomed-in shot of him landing on the friggin' mattress, or the crash pad, you could do the same thing they did with Shane and Blackman all those years ago. You can pan out to where when Jericho falls, he falls out of camera view. You hear the crash, but you don't actually see it. And then they have a few seconds to kind of look it over on the replay and said, all right, this doesn't look too bad. We'll replay it at a bunch of different angles. But if it does kind of look bad, you don't have to replay it at that angle. You can make that judgment call after the fact, but you have this really dramatic shot as you kind of pan out slowly of Jericho falling, but you don't actually see the crash. You hear it, or you see the expression on MJF's face up on top, but he falls out of camera view. That was the entire basis of my criticism. And I think the criticism that a lot of other people had as well. It wasn't that, you know, goddamn, when I watched this match, I was expecting Jericho to go splat right on the floor. And boy, am I disappointed that that didn't happen. Who is saying this? Where are these people? It's like the people who many people say that many people. Who are these people? I want you to be specific. Who are these people? They don't exist. They don't exist. They're a figment of their imagination. And these people are idiots who wasted their energy and wasted their breath trying to make this argument like it was going to make them look cool. Oh my God, I can't believe all these podcasters and all these people who are upset. And these are the people with checks next to their name as if they're supposed to be some kind of great authority. And I'm like, these are the people who are putting this out. It's one thing, again, if you're an unknown egg on Twitter, but that wasn't the case. I was appalled. I mean, I always expect to see stupid shit on social media, but from some of these people, absolutely ridiculous. Nobody argued that. Nobody at any point said that. These people know better. Don't listen to these people. Use common sense. It's a very fair criticism. I have found that there are a lot of AEW fans who melt down at the slightest criticism of the product, as if AEW can do no wrong. We went through this years ago with the TNA cult. Remember them? The TNA army, or whatever the hell they called themselves. I dedicated many segments on this show to those people. A lot of them belonged in a padded room with their shoelaces taken away from them. I don't want to have to start going off on the AEW diehards every week for the same thing. This is not a team sport. You're not pinch hitting for them off the bench. It's okay to critique things when there are things to critique, and nobody is asking for anyone to be splattered on concrete. Now, they had a segment on this show Wednesday with Darby Allin. He took this wicked bump down a flight of concrete stairs. He may have been wearing padding, but even still, this looked completely brutal. He's going to be defending his TNT title this Wednesday against Miro. And they're really setting it up with the injury being an excuse should he drop the belt, which I expect him to do. I think we're going to have a new champion this week. We've got SCU challenging the Young Bucks for the AEW tag team titles. And remember, if SCU loses, they're done. They're finished as a team. Jon Moxley defends the IWGP United States Championship against Yuji Nagata. And we've got a world title eliminator match, PAC, one-on-one against Orange Cassidy. And the winner will go on to challenge Kenny Omega for the championship at Double or Nothing on May 30th. I'm hoping for PAC. I'm pulling for PAC. I just think that's going to be a much better match. But look, OC, he's over. The AEW fans, they love him. I think if he wins on Wednesday, they're going to be happy. They're going to be happy to see a fresh match. We have not seen Kenny Omega one-on-one against Orange Cassidy, so that is a match we've not seen before. But me personally, I'm pulling for PAC. I think that would be a hell of a main event if they went back. And again, PAC has a history. He's beaten Omega before. So there is a story there you could tell where going in, it's like, here's a guy who's beaten Kenny Omega. He can do it again. They are planning, by the way, full capacity seating at Daly's Place on the 30th for Double or Nothing. So that's going to be around 5,000 people that they are planning for. Apparently this has to do with some kind of Machine Gun Kelly concert, I guess, that was recently hosted at Daly's Place, and the belief is that everything was fine, and so now they're going to move ahead and do full capacity seating for Double or Nothing. And that's fine if that's their decision. I'm just wondering, how do they know that everything was fine? How do we know this? Are they tracking everybody who was at this Machine Gun Kelly concert? I love this, like, everybody was fine, so we're just going to go ahead and have 5,000 people in the building. Okay, I would love to know how they know this. Were they tracking these people? Did they implant a chip in them as they left the building? I don't know. This has not yet been explained. Daniel Bryan lost to Roman Reigns 2 weeks ago, and he was banished from SmackDown per the stipulation of their match. And I thought it was only a matter of time before he showed up in NXT for a few matches or wound up on the Raw brand, and they built up to one last big match with him and Bobby Lashley, you know, him challenging for the WWE Championship, maybe at SummerSlam before his contract expired. As it turns out, his contract was not up in September. His contract was up after his match with Roman Reigns. Daniel Bryan, for the first time in over a decade, is now officially a free agent. This, according to Fightful.com, who broke the news. Bryan has already been moved to the alumni section on WWE.com, and internally he has been removed from the company's roster. Now, it is still very possible that he and WWE will reach a new agreement, and maybe he will end up on Monday Night Raw. Maybe he will end up challenging Bobby Lashley at some point later this summer. Bryan has said in interviews that he's been trying to work out a deal that would allow him to stay with WWE, but work for other promotions. And I think that there is a better chance of Jim Cornette signing with AEW as the manager of the Young Bucks than of WWE signing Bryan and allowing him to work Tokyo Dome matches, okay? For now, though, he can spend more time at home with Brie and Birdie and Buddy. And if WWE does not want to play ball, I would really like to see him as the traveling veteran before he ultimately retires and calls it quits. Let him work in AEW. Let him work in Ring of Honor. Let him work a match in MLW. New Japan. Work an independent match against Samoa Joe. Whatever. All of it. Whatever he thinks would be the most fun. You know, this is a man, don't forget, who was robbed of 3 years of his career and was not sure that he would ever be allowed back in the ring again. This should be his time to make his own schedule and do the big dream matches that he has always wanted to do. He's talked about wanting to work in Japan. He's talked about wanting to do a hair match or a hair versus mask match in Mexico. He's been very open about this in the past. Now is the time, if he's ever going to do this, for him to go out and do whatever it is that he feels he wants to do before he hangs it up. But WWE is still said to be working hard to sign him to a new deal. Nothing is official yet. And I don't watch much of MLW, but that might be about to change after the big reveal at the end of this week's season finale of MLW Fusion. So some background first, for those who don't know. Earlier this year, the Promociones Dorado faction, which is run by Selena De La Renta, was sold to a group called Azteca Underground, and someone calling himself El Jefe, a mystery man that De La Renta apparently owed a lot of money to. The storyline goes back even earlier than that, almost a year ago, in fact, when Conan alleged that De La Renta's group was suffering from financial hardship, and she owed a lot of money to some very dangerous people. After the group was sold, Selena brought Mil Muertes into MLW, which probably should have been a tip-off of something right there, but they were unsuccessful in trying to win the promotion's national openweight title, which did not make El Jefe very happy. Then last week on Fusion, De La Renta was abducted, and at the end of this week's episode, they cut to a scene which looked just like something out of Lucha Underground, even identifying the city that they were showing as Boyle Heights, California. The location of the old temple on Lucha Underground. And with a hood over her head, she was brought into someone's office and they put her in a chair. And That someone turned out to be Dario Cueto, the owner and proprietor of Lucha Underground. He is back. Dario is back. Dario is El Jefe, and he is the leader of Azteca Underground. He said that all he asked for was gold and violence, and she could not deliver. He said that he is building a new temple, which requires certain sacrifices. And with that, she was whisked away, presumably to be killed off. Then his phone rang, he answered it, and whoever was on the other end, he told them he would see them July 10th in Philadelphia, which is the date of the next MLW TV taping, which they are doing at the old ECW arena, the 2300, they call it, in front of actual fans. I don't know how many people are going to be there, but, you know, MLW has been taping in front of no one. And so this is the first time they're going to have a return to fans since the start of the pandemic. July is when MLW is going to begin producing new episodes of Fusion. And the actor playing Dario is going to be making regular appearances on the show going forward as, MLW, per PW Insider, has signed him to a long-term deal, which is fantastic news. That put a big smile on my face when I saw that. As somebody who is so tired of authority figures in wrestling and on wrestling shows, I always said Dario is the one I never got tired of. He was my favorite out of all of them. So they have piqued my interest with this. And, you know, now MLW is airing on Vice. I guess the way they're going to fill time between now and July 10th is they're going to be showing past episodes of Fusion, but I think they're going to be trying to bring people up to speed on all the storylines. In advance of the next, I guess the start of the next season, you would call it. I may have to work this into my rotation this summer when they come back. They have piqued my interest. Now on the plus side, them seemingly killing off Selena De La Renta, I'm hoping might mean a return for Katrina as the manager of Mil Muertes. Or I guess they're calling him King Muertes now. But on the negative side, them seemingly killing off De La Renta is because she is done with the promotion. And it sounds like this was an MLW call and not hers. Judging by some of her tweets, I think if you read between the lines, I'm not sure this was a completely mutual parting of the ways, which is sad to hear. She really was a cornerstone of that company. She's been there for many years. And from what I have seen of her as a manager and as a personality, she's really good, and she deserves to land somewhere high profile. That would mean WWE main roster, that would mean NXT, or that would mean AEW. Now, AEW already has a lot of managers. They don't even know what to do with some of their managers. We barely even see people like Jake Roberts and Vicky Guerrero. If they're giving Jade Cargill a manager and it turns out not to be Zelina Vega, I think Selena could work in that spot, but you know, NXT could work too. She could easily be featured on Raw and SmackDown, but, I mean, you know how that goes. It could work, or it could end up being a complete waste of talent. But she did say, in response to somebody on Twitter, she said she would love to go to WWE. So the ball is in her court. If they want her, then they could probably have her. Former WWE champion Jinder Mahal worked the main event tapings before Raw this week and looks to be paired off as a trio with the members of Indu Share, who he tagged with at that Superstar Spectacle show in January that they did for the Indian market. Indu Share was a team on NXT for all of probably 2 weeks, managed by Malcolm Bivens before one of the members spoiled the outcome on Instagram of the Keith Lee, Adam Cole, winner-take-all match at the NXT Great American Bash show in July. We didn't see them again after that. But the fact that they would re-debut Jinder on main event and not Raw, because I got two emails from people who were wondering why would they do this, even though the person said I'm not a big Jinder Mahal fan, but he is a former WWE champion, why would they not just, you know, do they not have enough time on a 3-hour Monday Night Raw show? I don't know what goes through these people's heads sometimes. I would think that given how much time he's missed, to me that's less surprising if you consider ring rust and all. That to me is less surprising than the fact that WWE now has Jeff Hardy doing jobs on main event. Jinder Mahal beat Jeff Hardy on main event. I just find that incredibly sad. But you consider the fact that he re-signed with the company not too long ago, so he knew what he was getting himself into when he did that. So, you know, if you feel badly for Jeff Hardy, don't feel too bad. Because he knew what he was doing when he signed on the dotted line. Now, Monday night, AJ Styles and Omos decided to show up 3 weeks after WrestleMania for the first time. As the new Raw Tag Team Champions, they had a WrestleMania rematch against the New Day. And the cringe moment of the match was listening to Adnan Virk ask Corey Graves where he thinks Omos ranks all time among the greatest champions in WWE history. The man was, as he said this, the man was wrestling his second match. I'd say he's pretty fucking low down on the list. I did like the phenomenal forearm finish from AJ off the big man's shoulders. That's some Diesel Shawn Michaels stuff right there. Although with Michaels, it was usually a splash off of his shoulders, not a forearm. Here's something that got people talking this week. We had a vignette for Eva Marie laying on top of a red Ferrari. She said, "Do I have your attention?" She talked about giving back and wanting to influence others to go after their own ambitions just like she did. This, she said, is evolution. I think if you read between the lines of what she said here, it sounds more like she's going to be a manager than a wrestler. All the people saying they fired Mickey James and they fired the Iconics to make room for someone like Eva Marie. Unless they knew they were going to fire Mickey James and the Iconics about 9 months ago, that doesn't wash, because this woman has been signed for over 6 months now. PW Insider broke the news of her signing back in September. So one does not have anything to do with the other. Now, if you want to sit here and argue their judge of talent and them getting rid of people like that for people like this, then that's a fair thing to debate. You know, Eva Marie, her best match was against Bayley. 6 years ago. 6 years ago, Bayley and Eva Marie had a women's championship match on an episode of NXT. And that was a troll job by Triple H, if I've ever seen one. A beautiful troll job, but a troll job all the same. Where they had the audience worried that she was actually going to win the title because she was getting this big push at that time, and she was pretty much, you know, she was pretty awful in the ring. And they had people convinced that, oh my God, they're going to have her beat Bayley and it'll be such great heel heat, right, to put the championship on her. And these people were into everything these women were doing in that match. It ended up being a really fun match to watch. And then she went to the main roster, and she did nothing outside of faking injuries for heel heat each time that she was scheduled to wrestle on SmackDown. They did that gimmick for a while. And then not long after that, she was gone. And she was off pursuing other interests in television and movies and whatever else it was that she was doing. We'll see if she's improved any in her time away. I mean, she's been signed since September. I would have to think in these last 6 months she's been doing some work at the PC. We'll see. We'll see if she's improved any. But you know, as bad as things have been with the women's divisions recently on these shows, I don't see how adding Eva Marie does anything to fix that. Nothing. Charlotte Flair was added to the Raw Women's title match at Backlash by Sonya Deville. So they're creating more tension each week between Sonya and Adam Pearce. You know, there's only one way to settle this. In the ring. Adam Pearce against Sonya Deville. My money is on Sonya. I have no idea what they're doing with Rhea Ripley. She was out here on the show acting like a heel. You know, when the announcement was made, she came out. She wasn't very happy about it. Charlotte is already completely unlikable. Asuka is a screaming lunatic. She's basically a cartoon character. I said it once and I'll say it again. When it comes to the women, not to mention a lot of other things, these people don't have a fucking clue what they are doing right now. Not a clue. Mansoor. Speaking of new people coming to Monday Night Raw, hey, at least they're adding some new faces, right? Eva Marie, Now we have Mansoor. He has arrived on the main roster. He also just got engaged. And as soon as he lands here on the main roster, his undefeated streak is over. He had the biggest streak going in the entire company. Unbeaten since 2019. Almost, I think, 50 straight matches was his streak. And that includes a 51-man battle royal that he won in Saudi Arabia. Gotta keep the Saudi prince happy. But that streak came to an end on Monday night against Sheamus, albeit by disqualification. There was a run-in by Humberto Carrillo. So, I mean, if you only count pinfall and submissions as losses, then I guess he would still be unbeaten. But if you want to be real technical about it, and you consider any type of loss, then he is no longer undefeated. You know, I've praised Mansoor in the past. He had a very limited run of matches on the NXT brand. This is going back to when they were still working matches at Full Sail. This is way before the pandemic hit. It was very, there was no consistency to his appearances. He would show up, he would disappear. We wouldn't see him for months on end. They'd have a Saudi Arabia show. They'd throw him on there. He would win. 4 months later, he'd do a match on NXT. Very weird. But when I would see him, I said, this guy is impressive. He can go. He can work. And now we see Sheamus is working with some of the younger faces and the newer faces on this show with Carrillo and Mansoor. That's good. The problem is that, especially in the case of Carrillo for so long, he wasn't booked to be anybody special. And in fact, he was booked to... We were conditioned to look at him as the guy that you beat. He was the job guy on the show, no matter how talented he may be. And then he went away and he improved his body. And, you know, it's nice to see him getting kind of a small little renewed push on this show. I don't think it's going to go anywhere. But if this is Sheamus's new gimmick, that he's going to be working with some of the newer faces on the Raw brand and, you know, defending the U.S. title, I can get behind that. It's better than the same old, same old. But the key is, can they create new stars? Because if Sheamus is just going to bro kick these guys every week and beat them, then I don't really see what the point of that is. Shouldn't the point be to get these guys over? I mean, even if they don't win the U.S. title, at some point they have to look competitive. So I don't know if we're going to get a triple threat. I don't know if we're going to get a couple of singles matches with Sheamus out of this, but I like where it's going. But as with everything, the key is in the follow-up, and I don't have a whole lot of faith in the people who are booking this show. Case in point, we have Shelton Benjamin and Cedric Alexander. Now, you know the disaster for them. The disastrous decision to break them away from the Hurt Business has done nothing for them, but they kept them together as a tag team, at least up until this week. They had a match against the Lucha House Party. If you had absolutely no sense of what they think of these guys, they came back from a commercial break and the match was already in progress. No entrances, no nothing. And Alexander and Benjamin were pretty dominant until Lince Dorado wiped out Alexander with a springboard dive. Grand Metalik gave Benjamin a rope walk elbow drop for the win. And Cedric was beside himself. He grabbed the mic. He started healing on Shelton Benjamin. Oh, no wonder MVP and Lashley kicked us out of the group. He goes, really? They probably wanted to kick you out of the group. And he said, you and me, we're done. We're finished. So Shelton Benjamin and Cedric Alexander as a team are no more. And they gave Shelton a little promo time backstage after this, and he was talking about how I've been here for so long, and when this is all over, I'll still be here, and Cedric, you know, you won't, you'll be an afterthought. If you recall what Shelton Benjamin was doing prior to the Hurt Business, you would know that this does not end well for him. And this probably does not end well for Cedric Alexander either. So I don't want to hear from anybody, oh, this is going to be the start of a big singles push for Cedric Alexander. You don't honestly believe that. I know that you want to believe that. I know that you are trying to convince yourself that that is true. But I'm telling you, you don't really believe that because you're smarter than that. This will not end well for either of these men. We had RK-Bro. Matt Riddle and Randy Orton, they won yet another match, this time over Elias and Jackson Ryker, who I saw this week. I thought I legitimately thought I was looking at a kayfabe news headline. He apparently was on some kind of faith podcast or Christian podcast. I don't know. He was on some kind of podcast. And they asked him who his favorite wrestler was. And Jackson Ryker said, "My favorite wrestler is Hulk Hogan." I just thought, I don't even think I read the rest of the article. I just went right to the comments. I said, I have to go right to the comments. And everybody said the exact same thing. They thought it was like an Onion article or a kayfabe news article. Because of course it would be. Of course it would be. RK-Bro, it looks like they're going to be a thing for some time. They're even having merchandise made for them. So if Randy Orton is going to be turning on Matt Riddle, it's not going to be happening for a while. When they're having t-shirts and merch made for you, they've got longer term plans for you. In fact, I think it's only a matter of time before these two guys end up as the Raw Tag Team Champions. And I am mildly amused by some of the stuff they've done with them on TV. I think this actually could end up being one of these pairings that they kind of strike gold with. It could end up being a really entertaining thing. So, you know, I'm keeping an open mind with it. It's different for Randy Orton because he plays the straight guy on TV so much. You don't usually see him laughing and yucking it up, and you don't see that now either. But these two are such polar opposites that Orton playing off of Riddle, I think, has some comedy potential. One thing that does not make me laugh, I do not find funny, I do not find amusing, I do not find entertaining in any way, shape, or form. Nia Jax. Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler. They won for a change, which sounds weird given that they're the tag team champions, but they have not exactly been dominant of late. They beat Lana and Naomi, but get this. Lana had Shayna Baszler pinned in the center of the ring. She got a visual pin on Shayna Baszler while the referee was distracted with Reginald. And then Baszler ended up winning with the Karafuta clutch. But of all the people on either roster that I would care to see involving in multiple storylines across multiple brands, Nia Jax would be near the very bottom of that list. And yet here we are. We've got Nia's ongoing story with Reginald, her boy toy. We've got Nia being made fun of and feuding with Mandy Rose and Dana Brooke. We've got Nia feuding with Tamina on SmackDown. We've got, you know, Tamina and Natty. And don't forget, we've got Angel Garza and Reginald, who are probably about to fight each other over Nia Jax. Am I missing something here? Is Nia Jax some kind of draw that I'm unaware of? Do her YouTube videos do 5 million views or something? Is there some secret Nia Jax t-shirt that's selling like hotcakes? Why is this woman so heavily featured on television? After a coin toss at the top of the show, Braun Strowman was picked for a non-title match with Bobby Lashley. Drew McIntyre sat ringside for it. Strowman plowed into him late in the match by accident. Drew, that is, and they got into a shoving match, and Strowman got back in the ring. He was distracted by McIntyre, who jumped up on the apron, and he turned around into a spear for the Bobby Lashley win. McIntyre then laid out both of his backlash opponents with Claymore kicks, and tomorrow night, it's Drew's turn to go one-on-one with Lashley, so they're doing everything they can to make the triple threat feel that much less special by putting these guys in the ring together every week between now and then. Like I said, I think Strowman is in there at the pay-per-view to take the losing fall so that Lashley's run can continue. But against who? Against who? That is the problem. They have no babyfaces at that level to challenge him for the championship. Drew McIntyre just feels very cold right now. Strowman is a corpse. He's already dead. But McIntyre just feels cold as a top babyface. So if Lashley were to retain, I don't know what the next obvious opponent is unless Keith Lee is about to come back, and I haven't heard a damn thing about his status. Orton and Riddle, they're doing their thing. AJ Styles is a tag team champion. He's a heel anyway. I'm talking like babyfaces. Who is there? Shift over to SmackDown. Friday night was billed as a throwback edition, only because NASCAR was doing the same thing this weekend with its programming, and so Fox wanted WWE to go retro, and they did the absolute bare minimum, a very lazy effort on their part. They opened with the old primetime wrestling music. At other points, they used the Linda McMahon WrestleMania theme. We didn't get the old SmackDown theme. It was nowhere. Nowhere. Nowhere that I heard, or at least they didn't open the show with it. They aired part of an old Ico Pro commercial and an old WWF ice cream bar ad. Michael Cole was dressed like his younger self in a denim shirt. Pat McAfee was wearing one of the old powder blue Vince McMahon suits. They used a version of the block letter logo from the 1980s. There was no fist, even though it's sitting in their warehouse. They used a CGI fist instead. Teddy Long was on the show doing comedy. Look, it was what it was. I don't watch SmackDown for 1980s graphics. I watch it because it's generally a better show than Raw, although that's a very low bar. We have to keep in mind that when we talk about SmackDown being such a great show, yeah, you know, some weeks it is, but a lot of weeks it's not. It's marginally better than Raw. When we compare things to Monday Night Raw, it is a very low bar. It comes up to our ankles. You take out the Roman Reigns stuff and the Cesaro match on this show, this wasn't much of a show. Jimmy Uso is back, finally, after 14 months on the shelf. He tore his ACL 14 months ago at WrestleMania. He came out, he embraced his brother Jay, he shook hands with Roman Reigns and Paul Heyman. The bloodline has been reunited. Cesaro then came out, he was attacked from behind by Seth Rollins, which is when Teddy Long came out and said Adam Pearce gave him the authority to add a stipulation to the Rollins-Cesaro match that the winner tonight would face Roman Reigns for the Universal Championship at Backlash. The Usos stayed ringside for the match. Roman went and watched from his locker room. Rollins sent Cesaro to the floor late in the match, and he stopped Jay from putting his hands on Cesaro. He told him to stay out of his business. He shoved Jey Uso to the ground. That's when Jimmy threw a super kick at Rollins. Back inside, Cesaro hit the neutralizer, and he pinned Rollins to get the shot at Roman Reigns at Backlash. And Roman was not happy about this development. Rollins angrily barged into Roman's dressing room. He wanted to know if he should blame Roman or his cousin for what just happened. Roman said that he also was upset because Rollins lost, and now he's got to deal with Cesaro. He said as for his cousin, he would take care of it. And Rollins told him, good, because if you don't, I will. There will definitely be a Seth Rollins-Roman Reigns match, but it should not be for at least a few more months. Would have been way too soon for that. And they're both heels anyway. Teddy Long was backstage, and he told Sami Zayn that he would be going one-on-one with The Undertaker. And Sammy pointed out that he was retired, and then he said Sammy instead would be in a 10-man tag, and one of his partners would be King Booker. Sonya Deville then corrected him and said, it's King Corbin. I'd rather have King Booker as my partner, personally. Then they did the Teddy Long dance, the Teddy Long shuffle, to end the segment, which Sammy said he was not in the mood to do, and he walked off. Holla holla. We had Roman Reigns confronting both Usos in the back. He was mad about Jimmy helping Cesaro win earlier. He said he and Jay have a good operation going. I allowed you to be part of it. You're back for 1 hour and already I gotta clean up the mess that you made. Jimmy was having none of this. He doesn't like being talked down to like his brother. And Jay glared at him when he said that. He said he wasn't anybody's bitch and he walked off. And Jay went to go talk to him and you know, Jay was upset because based on what Jimmy said, he goes, you must think that I'm Roman's bitch. He said, what's best for Roman is best for the family. And Jimmy said, dude, you're the one fighting all of his battles. If you ever needed him, he wouldn't be there for you the way that you're there for him. And he told Jay, I need you. With Roman as the Universal Champion, you and I, we could be the SmackDown Tag Team Champions. He said, that would be representing the family. Carmella beat Ruby Riott. 2-minute match. Beat her with the code of silence. We had a Bayley segment as well on this show that was interrupted by Bianca Belair. who attacked her. Bailey grabbed hold of Bianca's earring. She was yanking on it before laying her out to end the segment. Dominic Mysterio, he rolled up and pinned Dolph Ziggler in a match that Dolph pretty much dominated. This now sets up father and son Mysterio challenging for the tag team titles at Backlash. This feels like a program to me where the heels win a couple of matches before Rey and Dominic finally get the big emotional title win. The only reason I'm second-guessing that is because the Usos are back, and if they want to put the tag titles on Jimmy and Jay, it would be better for them, I think, to win them off Rey and Dominic than to win it from Roode and Ziggler. I also think if you do the Usos against Rey and Dominic, I think that'd be a fucking great match. So I think this could go either way. It just depends if they want to put the belts on the Usos, then I would think they're going to want to do that, you know, fairly soon, as in within the next month or so. They booked a match between Tamina and Reginald. Fucking atrocious. All of this. I hate all of this. I hate all of this. I hate everybody involved in putting this entire story together. Reginald did some flips that were supposed to impress. You know, maybe in 1988, it would have impressed me. In 2021, when everybody and their mother and their father and their first cousin does flips, it's not impressive. It is a waste of television time. And Tamina couldn't even get a clean win on Reginald because Baszler shoved her off the top rope for the DQ. I guess to put heat on the heels ahead of their tag team title match this Friday. It is hard for me to articulate how little I care about any of this. And these segments continue to drag down whatever show that they're on. And they're on every fucking show. They're on Raw, they're on SmackDown, they're on SmackDown, they're on Raw. Awful. Apollo Crews, Otis, Chad Gable, King Cockroach, and Sami Zayn beat Big E, Kevin Owens, Shinsuke Nakamura, and the Street Profits. The Cockroach pinned Nakamura with the End of Days. They got a bunch of people on TV, I guess, so there you go. The show closed with Roman Reigns and Paul Heyman in the ring, and Jimmy Uso wanting to know where his brother stands. He talked about Hell in a Cell last year and him saving his brother when Roman had him locked in the guillotine and wouldn't let go. Reigns told Jimmy to fall in line and acknowledge him, and if not, he can go home and watch SmackDown with his kids. Jimmy left the ring, Jay went after him and tried to convince him to do the right thing as this was going on in the aisleway. Cesaro jumped Roman Reigns inside the ring, Jay jumped in, Cesaro beat him down. Jimmy ran in to save Jay. Cesaro propelled him up into the air for the big uppercut. Fucking love that. And then he hit Jay with the neutralizer. He hit the neutralizer on Roman. They kept Cesaro strong. I like that. I like that, and I don't know if it ends up being a swerve with Jimmy, and, you know, we find out that he was perfectly aligned with Roman all along, or if he just simply comes around eventually the way that his brother did, but Jimmy is going to play a role in Cesaro losing at Backlash. There's no doubt in my mind. And Cesaro is not winning the title. I mean, that's more easily predictable. I don't know anybody who thinks he's actually going to win the championship. Both Usos are soon going to be united as one with the Tribal Chief, and they will end up with the tag team titles as well as the Universal title. I thought this was a very good show-long angle. It was the main thing, frankly, that carried the entire thing. No new Aleister Black vignette this week because the show ran a little bit long and so they had to cut it. And I would assume that next week they'll air the latest segment. Now I want to ask you guys a question. Have you ever browsed in incognito mode? You've probably seen that in the Chrome browser. It's the one that I use. You see incognito mode. It's probably not as incognito as you think. And why would it be? Incognito mode, like the Chrome browser itself, it's a Google product. Google has made its fortune by tracking your movements online. There's even a $5 billion class action lawsuit against the company in California, where it is accused of secretly collecting user data. And Google's defense is that incognito does not mean invisible. So how do you actually make yourself as invisible as possible online? You do it with ExpressVPN. Turns out that even in incognito mode, your online activity still gets tracked. And brokers still get to buy and sell your data. One of these data points is your IP address. Data harvesters use your IP to uniquely identify you and your location. But with ExpressVPN, your connection gets rerouted through an encrypted server and your IP address is masked. Every time you connect to ExpressVPN, you get a random IP address shared by many other ExpressVPN customers. That makes it harder for third parties to identify you and harvest your data. Best of all, ExpressVPN is super easy to use, no matter what device you're on, phone, laptop, smart TV. All you have to do is tap one button for instant protection. So if you really want to go incognito and protect your privacy, secure yourself with the number one rated VPN. Visit expressvpn.com/solomonster and get 3 extra months for free. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. expressvpn.com/solomonster. I watched the Macho Man Randy Savage documentary on A&E, and this one hit differently than the first two, especially that second hour, which took a decidedly darker turn. And considering the number of people they interviewed for this, I thought it was notable that one person they did not interview, or who declined to be interviewed if she was ever invited, was Randy's wife. And having now watched this, I can understand why she would have wanted nothing to do with it. They interviewed a lot of people: Vince McMahon, Bruce Pritchard, Lanny Poffo, and they had footage from 2014 of their mother, Jimmy Hart, Honky Tonk Man, Hulk Hogan is all over it, as you would imagine, Sting, Jake Roberts, Ricky Steamboat is on there talking about their WrestleMania 3 match. There is a hilarious moment, by the way, during this where Hulk Hogan, they talk about the WrestleMania 3 match, and they go into great detail about how Randy wrote every step down, they mapped it out, and they would study all the moves for weeks in advance. And Hulk Hogan claims that those two guys, they didn't go out there to try to upstage me and Andre in our match. And then they immediately cut to a clip of Ricky Steamboat, who they interviewed, saying, "That's exactly what we went out there to do. That was our sole intention, was to go out there and to steal the show and top the main event." So yet another, it's nice to see Hogan in that one scene in the middle of this special, called out on his bullshit. But they interviewed Lex Luger, whose name they misspelled on the screen. They called him Lex Lugar. Jerry Lawler talked about Randy coming to Memphis and working with him after his father's promotion, ICW, had fallen on hard times, which was, you know, at the time, was kind of a big deal. Savage was trying to lobby for a match with Lawler, and they were trying to get under Lawler's skin for the longest time, and you know, they didn't really take the bait until, again, they fell on hard times and they had no choice but to do business. And once they worked together, they did business, you know. And it was very cool seeing footage from ICW in Memphis instead of them just diving right into the start of his WWE run and pretending that stuff never happened. Peter Rosenberg was all over this thing, which is not surprising given the WWE involvement in these projects. So was comedian Dan Soder, who does one of the best Randy Savage impressions that I have ever heard. I remember the first time I heard him do it was at the Roast of the Iron Sheik, which ironically was hosted by Rosenberg. It was at Caroline's on Broadway in New York, the week of WrestleMania 29. I don't even think I had ever heard of Dan Soder before. And there he was up on the dais, and he was roasting the Iron Sheik and talking about him. And when he did that Savage impression, and I think Jay Lethal was there too in full Savage regalia, and he does one of the best Savage impersonations you'll ever see. But then I heard Soder's voice, and I was like, oh my God, if I closed my eyes, I would have thought that Savage was right there at the dais. Now, the first hour or so covered a lot of the stuff that you would expect them to cover, even before the ICW and Memphis stuff. Landy talked about his baseball career in the minor leagues and how, after a home plate collision, he was able to throw and hit both left-handed and right-handed, which you would think would make him a desirable entity to a lot of teams, and yet the way his brother tells it, a lot of teams thought he looked weird doing it, I guess, and so that's why they passed on him. That doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, knowing what I know about minor league baseball. It's far more likely he just wasn't good enough to make the cut. I would estimate that probably a good 85% of the players at a minor league level will never make it to the majors for a full career. It is not an easy thing to do. So that is when he decided to get into the family business, and they talked about once he came to WWE, him being courted by every heel manager and introducing Miss Elizabeth as his choice as his manager, who he had married in 1984, even though they never acknowledged their marriage on TV at the time. They had the thought that she would come in as an announcer. She had been doing announcing for the Poffos and ICW. But once Vince McMahon took a look at her for the first time, you know, that was it. He said, there's no way this woman can be just an announcer. We got to get her on the show as a character. This woman is gorgeous. And she really was. I mean, Liz was every wrestling fan's crush at that time. Every male fan, anyway. And probably some females, too. They talked about the man behind his colorful outfits, who was someone Hulk Hogan introduced him to, that used to do the outfits for Hogan's band when Hogan was in a band, not Metallica. They talked about Vince McMahon downplaying him in the mid-90s and wanting him to be a commentator, and Randy didn't want to be a commentator. He thought he had more left in the tank. And this is when Vince was going for more of a youth movement in the company. Jerry Lawler repeated a story that he has told for years about the night they all found out about Randy Savage having jumped to WCW. He said Vince McMahon was looking for Savage one night at TV before the show to go over the format, and they had a TV in the back, and they all saw Savage walk out on WCW television, and Lawler says Vince totally no-sold it and just looked over at him and asked him if he would fill in for Randy that night. That absolutely 100% did not happen. Now, it is very likely that they expected Savage at the show that night, and negotiations broke down, and he no-showed, and Vince went to Lawler and said, look, I need you to fill in for Randy. And Lawler is probably conflating that with something else, Luger showing up on Nitro the following year with people in the back watching on TV being all shocked. This was in 1994. There was no WCW Monday Nitro in 1994, so there was no other show to put on that night. Not only that, Vince McMahon went on the air and gave this heartfelt goodbye speech to Savage live on the air, talking about how they couldn't come to terms on a new contract. In fact, they aired this footage in the documentary. It wasn't until a month after that that Savage showed up on WCW television. It was on WCW Saturday Night. So him showing up in WCW a month later was not really much of a surprise. It was well known at that time that he wasn't coming back to WWE, and he was in talks with Bischoff in WCW. And you know what? I don't even blame Lawler for this, because he's told the story so many times, he probably really believes it. That is now his recollection of events. In the words of George Costanza on Seinfeld, it's not a lie if you believe it. So I don't blame... It's one of the reasons I think if Hulk Hogan was ever given a lie detector test, the fucker would pass. So I don't blame Lawler. I blame the producers for not realizing the story was bullshit. And if they knew it was horseshit but kept it in anyway, then that's even worse. That is a horrible misstep on their part. The second half of this took a real dark turn. And I want to talk about this because a lot of people were very upset. I don't have an issue with them covering the dark parts of Randy Savage's life. He was no saint. And that was really one of the takeaways even from the Brian Pillman documentary. The Dark Side of the Ring episode. He was no saint either. None of these people are. And those dark parts are part of this man's life story. I don't want a puff piece. I want something that covers all the bases. But they're doing these in cooperation with WWE. So I already know going in that there are going to be certain things that are off limits. I want consistency. And if you watch the episodes on Steve Austin and Roddy Piper, especially the one with Austin, and then you watch the Savage one, there is a big gap there. there were things that Austin did, namely the stuff with Deborah, that were not covered in his episode. But it was news at the time that it happened. And Austin himself has talked about doing other things that he shouldn't have been doing or taking after his career was cut short. You know, 03, 04, 05. Those were really dark years for Steve Austin. And they didn't go into really any of that either, and I'm sure he didn't want to go there. And if you don't have his cooperation, then you don't have a documentary. So, I get it. But if they don't want to get that dark with these, that's fine. This isn't meant to be Dark Side of the Ring. We already have Dark Side of the Ring on the other channel. But they should strive for consistency, I think, as much as possible with these specials. Part of the issue is that A&E has different production companies producing different episodes. WWE is supplying them with the footage that they need. WWE is supplying them with the talking heads for a lot of the interviews. But these different production teams are otherwise, supposedly, left to tell the story in a way that they want to tell it. And these individuals were clearly going heavy more on the salacious stuff because they thought it would make for better TV. You know, you really can't cover the career of Randy Savage without mentioning Elizabeth. But this was almost like a documentary on Randy and Liz, not just Randy Savage. They covered the breakup of their marriage. Hulk Hogan told the story of where the heat with Randy stemmed from. Randy blamed Hogan for his marriage falling apart, which he did. Savage was open about that at the time. There was a radio WWF interview in 94. 93, maybe late 93. That Savage did that I've read transcripts of it. I wish there was audio of that available. I don't know of anybody who has the old WWF radio recordings. I wish they did. There was one episode, you know, Jim Ross used to host it, and Savage went on, and it was like, he just shot all over Hogan. And so, yeah, it was bad. He definitely held Hogan responsible for a lot of his marriage woes. Hogan claimed ignorance here on the special. He said Liz was just staying at their house. Liz had become good friends with them and with Hulk's wife, Linda, over the years. And at the end there, she was staying with them. I don't know if she was staying with them or she would just come over sometimes and stay over. They had a room for her. Hogan said he had no idea that Liz was also seeing another man. It wasn't just that she came over one day and said, hey, can I stay over in the guest room? She had left Randy and didn't tell anybody. And then they interview Lex Luger about the night they were home doing pills and drinking and Liz died. They interviewed Eric Bischoff and his wife, Lori. Separately, they interviewed the both of them for the documentary. Lori got a lot of screen time talking about Liz as well because the two of them were friends. It was to the point where I think it felt out of place in what was supposed to be a special about Randy Savage, who by that point, you know, wasn't even with Elizabeth anymore. They interviewed Bubba the Love Sponge for this, who's a complete waste of skin. Why did they think Bubba the Love Sponge needed so much airtime in a Macho Man Randy Savage documentary? Because he was friends with Hogan and they used to mock him on the radio show when Hulk and Randy, when they were at odds with one another. Bubba said, oh, I'd have Hulk on and we would just, you know, make fun of Randy. Nobody gives a fuck about Bubba the Love Sponge. His big claim to fame is that he let Hulk Hogan fuck his wife and he recorded the whole thing. You could have replaced him with an actual sponge and the sponge would have been more insightful. This is where having another wrestling personality in his place, like a Diamond Dallas Page, would have made this far better. When it came to Savage's WCW stuff, he did some of his best work with DDP. He made DDP's career. He's got some great stories, and he told him, when I had DDP on the podcast twice, the first time I had him on, it was to talk about the Goldberg match at Halloween Havoc when I was doing my WCW matches countdown, and it just veered off into stories about working with Randy Savage, and he got all emotional, and it was great. Those are stories that should be told on a TV special like this. You know, Savage was far more giving with him than a lot of the top guys would have been back then. And Paige could have spoken to that. Instead, they completely glossed over his time there and just focused on the Hogan stuff. But the most egregious to me of all the talking heads and everybody who I saw was you know, Bubba the Love Sponge. Get him the fuck off my television. He has no business being on here. But Savage's paranoia was on full display. With the Gorgeous George talk, they interviewed her. She was Randy's valet in WCW. She was a dancer, stripper, at a club when they first met. She was 23 years old at the time. Randy would have been 47. I know, I can't believe things didn't work out. I'm as shocked as you are. But her account of things was pretty damning. And she talked about his steroid use in WCW, which, I mean, I don't... It's one of those things where I don't need anybody to tell me that Randy Savage was doing steroids in WCW. You just kind of watch Randy Savage and his transformation, and you kind of know what was going on there. He went a little nutty with that. She said he was very self-conscious about his appearance. And she claims that he had a process where they would visit his father's house, and he would go upstairs with Angelo so that his pops could... quote, give Randy his medicine, and she would stay downstairs. She talked about all the ecstasy that he was doing and how he would carry those pills around with him everywhere in his fanny pack. Things ended between them when she was doing some cleaning at his house one day, and she claimed she discovered screens with security cameras showing different rooms in her house. He had her house bugged. He was spying on her. But she made it a point to say, look, with Randy, the things that were good with him were very good, but the things that were bad were very bad. And when they talked about Randy's car accident and the way that he died, he had a heart attack and he veered off the road into a tree. Dan Soder talked about what a macho way that was to die. Oh, yes, it was so very macho man to drive into a tree and almost kill his wife in the passenger seat. And who knows how many other people. Had his wife not reached over to steer the car away from oncoming traffic. Who talks like that? Who says something like that out loud? What a weird thing to say. I would have liked to see them focus more on why Savage was blackballed from WWE for so long. They got Vince McMahon for an interview, and they either didn't ask him, or he didn't give them an answer. And I understand you're working in cooperation with WWE, so you don't want to push too hard. You don't want to, and especially the boss, right? You don't want to piss them off. But that is a question that has to be asked. That is something that would have been very relevant to his life story and his career story that I would have liked some clarity on. How often do you get Vince McMahon in a seat talking about Randy Savage? That's probably never going to happen again. He's already in the Hall of Fame. They already did the DVD. There is no other reason ever again for the rest of his remaining days on this earth for Vince McMahon to agree to sit down to an interview and talk about the Macho Man. You got one shot at this, and they didn't take it. Was it the loss of the Slim Jim deal? That seems to be the prevailing thought. To me, it feels more personal than that. I think it was Chris DeJoseph who said that when he was a writer in WWE... you know, Big Dick Johnson, he was always told to not even mention Savage's name. Don't even bring his name up around Vince. There's a story about Michael Hayes once pitching an idea to Vince McMahon in a meeting about bringing Savage back. And all Vince did was look off into the distance and said very calmly, I do not want to do business with that man. I'm sure he felt betrayed when Randy left, but think of all the other people he must have been burned by over the years, from Hogan, all the names, all the big names that had falling outs with him. And eventually they all came back. They were all brought back. You know, Bischoff on the special said that he basically ended up paying Randy nothing on his first contract because he brought the Slim Jim deal with him. And that was a $750,000 a year deal. And I think Randy's first contract with WCW was for $750,000. So it kind of paid for itself. And I could see Vince McMahon feeling like, hey, that's our deal. And they did have other people step in for Randy after he left to do those commercials. Bam Bam Bigelow was one of them. I don't think they did much after that as far as Slim Jim goes. Savage took it with him. And at a time when WWE probably needed the money. Business was not exactly booming for them in 94 and 95. So that's the closest thing I could think of, is that he just really felt burned by not only him leaving, but taking the deal with him. But again, to me, it just feels like there's something more to it than that. It just felt more personal to me than that. And, you know, look, we may never know for sure what the real answer is. So it would have been nice to pin him down and try to get an answer. But that's not the sort of thing these people who put this together appear to be all that interested in. You know, again, it's less a matter of the stuff on Savage being untrue and more about how if you choose to ignore certain aspects of other people's life stories, then how are you going to lay bare all of Savage's scars and not theirs? Look, Macho Man is one of my all-time favorites. He was the complete package as far as pro wrestlers go. He could wrestle, he could bump, he could get wildly entertaining on promos, he had charisma coming out of his pores, he could play the hero, he could play the villain, he was a better villain than a hero. He had the colorful costumes. Next to Hogan, to this very day, he is still the number one wrestler, I guess he would be number two, who is most dressed up as for Halloween every year. You still, even in 2021, you will find way more people dressed up as Hulk Hogan and the Macho Man Randy Savage on Halloween than you will find people dressed as The Rock or John Cena or Edge or Roman Reigns or even John Cena, any of the current stars. It's always Hogan and Savage, and I know this because I've dressed up as both of them myself, and I see it. So, people loved that stuff. There was no one as colorful as he was, but he was human, and he wasn't perfect. And you cannot gloss over the negatives. I just think the amount of time they dedicated to all of it really did not do him any justice. Now, the Ultimate Warrior is, speaking of colorful, literally and figuratively, the Ultimate Warrior is going to make very clear, I think, who is giving us a more accurate depiction of things. Because Warrior is not just getting a biography episode on A&E. He is getting the Dark Side of the Ring treatment this season as well. We're getting a double dose of the Ultimate Warrior. And I think it kind of says right there in the title, you know that his Dark Side of the Ring episode is not going to paint him in a very positive light. And it should. The man was a raving lunatic. But will A&E offer a similar view? That's the question. Just keeping with the A&E stuff for a second, I also watched the latest episode from last weekend of WWE's Most Wanted Treasures. This time it was Jerry the King Lawler. And Lawler owns a lot of collectibles, a lot of memorabilia, not just wrestling. Batman, Superman, all kinds of stuff. The man owns a Batmobile that he drives around the streets of Memphis for crying out loud, okay? That tells you that he's a big collector. But he also retained a lot of his own stuff, including his crowns and his robes that he's worn over the course of his career. And so one of the things that they wanted from him, that the WWE folks over there wanted to put in their warehouse, and I guess put in a future Hall of Fame, is his original crown and robe for the King of the Ring in 1993. When Bret Hart won the tournament, Lawler came out to confront him. Lawler beat up Bret Hart and kicked off their feud. And they didn't have that. And Lawler took, you know, AJ Francis is the one who they have going around. He's in NXT at the moment, former NFL player. So he brings AJ over to his house and they're going through Lawler's closet. And there it is. There's the crown and the robe from King of the Ring 1993. And they put a price on it. And that was one of the stories of the whole episode. Lawler wasn't sure he wanted to part with it. And at the end, of course, he agrees to part with it. They really, you know, claimed they wanted it from him. He ended up agreeing to a sale price of $10,000. They went to Dave Millican's house. Dave Millican has in his possession the t-shirt, although that's not why they were there, but he has in his possession the t-shirt that Lawler was wearing on Raw the night he died and was brought back to life. But Dave gave them a pair of Lawler ring-worn boots from some of the matches that he had with Andy Kaufman in Memphis. You know, again, he really didn't want to part with them, but they convinced him. They got Triple H on Zoom or Skype or whatever, FaceTime. And they had to really work on him, but he agreed to sell it to them for $5,000 plus a custom piece of artwork Lawler sat down in his house, in Dave's house, right there on the spot, and drew a caricature of him. He drew an illustration of him. Lawler is an unbelievable artist. I mean, whatever you think of Jerry Lawler, he is an amazing artist. I mean, Bret Hart does too. Bret Hart does illustrations. He draws, but not like Lawler. Lawler is a fucking pro. I mean, he does some amazing work. I still don't know that $5,000. I mean, it just seems like they're lowballing these people. This is a pair of ring-worn boots that Jerry Lawler wore in Memphis for his matches with Andy Kaufman. I don't know, $5,000 to me? You don't think that at some kind of wrestling auction he couldn't fetch at least two or three times that amount from somebody? With all the money the WWE has to throw around? They give out offers like $2,500 for this, $5,000 for that. Please. I would tell them that you're insulting me, and I would kick them out of my house. But Bill After made an appearance. It was very cool to see Bill. I've had him on the show before. He is the one who actually introduced Andy Kaufman and Jerry Lawler. And Lawler talked about that here on the special. So they went to After's Alley, which reminded me, when I talked to Bill on the podcast many years ago, he invited me to come on out to Pennsylvania and come on by After's Alley, and I never took him up on that. But maybe one of these days. But After's Alley is basically just, you know, his basement, and he's got all this wrestling memorabilia and stuff that he's collected from over the years. What they were looking for, they were wondering if anybody had possession of the neck brace that Andy Kaufman wore. Because after, you know, he got pile-driven by Lawler, Andy was wearing a neck brace for a while, wouldn't take the damn thing off after he came out of the hospital. And they were wondering, man, if we can figure out who has possession of that neck brace, because Dave Millican didn't have it, and then it just so happens, Lawler says, well, if anybody would have it, it would be Bill After. And they go to Pennsylvania, and they visit, and wouldn't you know, in After's Alley, they look over, and hanging from the wall just so happens to be the neck brace. And they go and they wonder, you know, would we be able to have this from you? And After gives it to them free of charge. Gratis. Didn't charge him anything for it. What a guy. So that was pretty much the episode. They got possession of Lawler's robe and crown from the King of the Ring in 93. And they got the ring-worn boots from Memphis, and they got the Andy Kaufman neck brace. So if the day ever comes that they do put together a Hall of Fame, and I guess even if they don't, if they ever get back to doing fan access on the road for WrestleMania and they put, you know, all kinds of stuff on display, they're going to have a pretty cool display of some Jerry Lawler stuff, and because apparently they didn't have any. You know, the guy, Ben Brown, who pretty much runs the warehouse over there, said, you know, we really don't have any Jerry Lawler stuff. And now they do. So I know the episode tonight, I think, has Steve Austin on it and Booker T. Booker T is the subject of the A&E biography tonight, so I will try to check that out during the week. But one more special I wanted to just talk about for a few minutes here before we get to This Week in History is the WWE Untold special on the network, on Peacock, on the two dudes with attitudes, Diesel and Shawn Michaels. I have a lot of memories from that New Generation era period of 94, 95. 95 was not a great year for WWE. I've talked about that before. But I have a lot of memories of Diesel and Shawn Michaels, you know, once they went babyface. And they walked around like they just owned the fucking place. Because I guess they kind of felt like they did, based on a lot of the stories that are told from that period. But they just worked together. They clicked. They were cool together. And this special runs just under an hour, a little over 50 minutes. They talk to Kevin Nash. They talk to Shawn Michaels, Bruce Pritchard, and David Shoemaker, who I guess is their resident historian now, is Shoemaker. We had footage, and I'm not going to go through everything here, but they had footage of Nash playing college basketball. He had gotten into a lot of trouble. He ended up in the military and playing military basketball. Blew out his knee the first time and came back to the States and ended up in Atlanta. And he was introduced to the Cheetah Club. Strip club. And they gave him a job there as the floor manager. And he was saying, you know, anybody who's ever works in the field of adult entertainment, you're never late for work. He says you get some nice scenery there at work. And obviously a lot of wrestlers, especially in Atlanta, they would frequent the Cheetah. And Barry Windham is the one who looked at him and said, hey, you got to get into the wrestling business. You're a big bastard. And that's how he first got his foot in the door in the wrestling business and started training. Now, Shawn Michaels, they talked about him growing up as a wrestling fan. We got some footage of a young Shawn Michaels working before he ends up in WWE as part of the Rockers. And he says, look, even though we never won the tag team titles, we were a very good team. And they showed the barbershop footage of him turning on Jannetty. And Shawn says, even with the heel turn, people in the company were very uncomfortable losing to him because he was a small guy. And he, you know, look, he's never going to be Hogan, never going to be the Warrior. It was still the land of the giants at the time. So Nash gets offered a contract by WCW. He's part of a team called the Master Blasters. He admits it was a way, basically, to make up for Vince taking the Road Warriors in 1990. They show his debut at the Clash of the Champions, and he starts laughing because his partner misses a headbutt by like 3 feet within the first 3 minutes, and the crowd saw that, and that was it. They lost him. They lost him. So at that point, Nash goes, it was at that very moment that I was wondering, I wonder what Candace and Joy are doing on top of those tables back at the Cheetah. From there, he became the almighty powerful Oz, which didn't last long, and then he became Vinnie Vegas. And it was as Vinnie Vegas that Shawn Michaels noticed him for the first time. He got Shawn's attention. Shawn said that, you know, at the time, Andrew Dice Clay was really hot, and Nash was the wrestling equivalent of, with that gimmick, of Andrew Dice Clay. He made him laugh. And he was the Intercontinental Champion at the time. A lot of his matches were ending on a disqualification or a countout, and he had pitched the idea of a bodyguard helping him cheat to win, because it would get him some real heat. And Vince McMahon said, well, who on the current roster do you have in mind? And Shawn said, well, I really don't see anybody here fitting that role. And he spit out the name Vinnie Vegas, and Vince told him they couldn't touch any of the WCW guys who were under contract. So a few months later, he mentioned the idea to Rick Steiner. And Rick Steiner says, oh, I'm friends with that guy. I'm friends with Kevin Nash. I'll get you his number. Before you know it, Nash is going to WCW and telling him, look, you know, things really aren't working out. I think I'm just going to go back to, you know, the club scene and bouncing and that kind of stuff. And they believed him. And they gave him his release. And I think the next day, he was on a flight to go meet Vince McMahon in Connecticut. And so things worked out. They signed a contract, and Vince told Nash, look, I got a limo. It's going to take you to Albany, New York. You're going to screw over Marty Jannetty at a live event. That was the live event where Shawn won the Intercontinental belt back from Jannetty. Jannetty had a very short run with it. Nash met Shawn for the first time. He couldn't believe how deep his voice was for such a small guy. Shawn warned him. He said, look, I got to tell you, not a lot of people like me right now in this company, and it's probably going to rub off on you by association. And Nash's response to him was, I got your back. And out of that, a beautiful friendship was born. And they covered them winning the tag team titles, and they started getting over as a team. And Vince McMahon told, you know, Michaels, hey, you know, Diesel's doing great. I'm thinking about putting the belt on him. And Shawn's thinking, well, you know, I had a little something to do with this myself. And that leads to Madison Square Garden in November of 94, right after the Survivor Series. Nash beats Bob Backlund for the championship in 8 seconds. And Nash said, look, when I beat Backlund for the belt, I was still green. He had less than 200 matches under his belt in his entire career. And we got footage of Diesel giving a promo in front of the live crowd after winning the belt. This was one of the coolest parts of the whole documentary, because I hadn't seen this footage before. The cameras follow him to the back at the Garden that night after his win. And he goes into the locker room, and we see King Kong Bundy is sitting down, I guess, after his match that night. He gets up. He's the first person to come over and congratulate Diesel and shake his hand. And then Captain Lou Albano comes in, and he shakes Diesel's hand. He congratulates him. So this was cool. Like, I love footage like this that we just have never seen before. And it makes you wonder how much more of this type of stuff is in the vault that's just sitting there. that, you know, we just never get to see. But he made it a point to mention, you know, Nash says Sean was lobbying for the belt, and it was Sean's dream. It was Sean's dream. Sean always wanted to be the champion. Nash says, I always wanted to be wealthy. It was not my dream. He wanted to be the champion. I wanted to be wealthy. And that was the big difference between the two of them. They talked about their WrestleMania 11 match. They did not include comments from Nash, as he gave in a shoot interview with Sean Oliver many years ago, where he mentioned that Sean tried to sabotage him on the finish on that awful-looking jackknife powerbomb, which Nash was convinced Sean did that on purpose because he said, look, Sean could take a powerbomb better than anybody. If he wanted to take that move the right way, he could have. But he took it the way that he did because he tried to sabotage me because Sean was gunning for my spot at that time. And that is something that Nash did talk about. He said, look, Sean clearly wanted to be in the spot that I was in. And they showed footage from the angle the night after WrestleMania with Sid turning on Shawn Michaels and powerbombing him three times. Diesel came in to make the save. And the two dudes with attitudes were formed out of this. And later on, Shawn's got the IC strap. Diesel's got the world title. Shawn realizes, hey, you know what would be cool? I wonder if any two people ever held all the titles. And they were wondering how much heat they would get from the boys if they held all of the belts. The answer, by the way, is a lot. A lot. And that takes us to the winner-take-all match where they won the tag belts from Yokozuna and the British Bulldog, who was subbing for Owen Hart, who came in right at the very end. And they didn't hold the belts, you know, for very long. And Bruce Pritchard says, oh, you know, looking back, it was a mistake because where do you go from there? I think they just gave the belts up, right? Because it was kind of a controversial finish. It's true. I mean, where do you go from there? There's really nowhere else to go at that point. But as a fan at the time, it was a cool thing. Nash wanted to get paid, which is ultimately what led him leaving for WCW. Well, I mean, that and Bret Hart not agreeing to take his finish in their cage match at the In Your House pay-per-view before WrestleMania 12. As I have documented here on the podcast fairly recently, that whole story, being in the back, it was Nash and Undertaker and Bret just wasn't feeling it. Nash was pitching the finish. Nah, I don't really like that idea. And that's where Undertaker piped up and said, motherfucker, not everything is about you. Which I just can't picture Undertaker saying, but I totally believe it happened. They didn't get into that, but the MSG curtain call, they showed the fan cam footage of that. Pritchard said he was watching from the aisle. He hated it. He felt it was disrespectful. It wasn't the right thing to do. And you know, Nash says, look, Sean was pissed. Not about the curtain call, but about the fact that he and Hall were leaving and Sean bitched at the both of them because he says, look, I've been putting you guys over for months and I gave you great matches, which you then turned around and used to get these massive contracts. And now you're leaving. You're turning around and you are leaving me. I am the champion now and you are leaving me short of two of the best guys for me to work with. And Nash says he was pissed, and Sean had a right to be. You know, they showed footage of Sean and Nash kind of hobnobbing backstage at Kevin's Hall of Fame induction. Nash talked about how, look, if Shawn Michaels does not pick me back in 93 to be his bodyguard, I don't get to enjoy all the successes that I've been able to enjoy in my life. And Nash, he had this great line. He goes, I've never met a person in my life that I would rather be other than myself. He says, I have no regrets. And Michaels talked about the issues that he was having in his life in 2001 and 2002. And he called Nash one night. He was, shall we say, in an altered state. And Diesel told him, look, buddy, I love you, but you got to get your shit together. You got a wife and a kid now. And within 48 hours, Michaels said he called Triple H, who he had not spoken with in probably a year. They didn't get into any of this as far as why, but yeah, he and Triple H, I think they didn't speak for almost a year because Sean had gotten sent home in 2001. And I think he harbored a lot of ill will towards Triple H for either, I don't know if he snitched on him because, you know, that night that Sean passed out in the back in Vince's office, or he just felt Triple H didn't stand up for him. So they weren't on speaking terms for a good year. But after that conversation with Nash, you know, Sean picked up the phone and called him, and they patched things up, and he realized it was time to get his act together, and he found God, and he says that he's never looked back, and he's been on the straight and narrow ever since. So it was short, like I said, it was a little over 50 minutes. I really enjoyed this one. I thought it was a nice little trip down memory lane. Nash is great in these things. He really is. His shoot interviews are just some of the best. I could listen to him tell stories for hours. NXT from Tuesday opened hot with a Falls Count Anywhere match and closed with a wild main event crowning new women's tag team champions. We had Isaiah Swerve Scott beating Leon Ruff in a Falls Count Anywhere match. I like the lack of weapons since they were obviously saving that for the main event. In hindsight, they really didn't need too much in the way of weapons. I mean, there was a toolbox that came into play. That was pretty much it. But I do wish they would have done a better job of taking advantage of the Falls Count Anywhere stip. You know, there was a brief period where Scott had dragged Ruff to an area with lockers in the back. But then it was quickly just right back out to the ring. And I just think they could have gotten more creative with the stipulation. But I mean, outside of that, I thought this was a lot of fun. I loved the Poison Rana spot off the apron with Ruff taking Swerve down to the floor. Ruff hit two cutters, one in the ring and one on the floor. And he then dove off this big camera perch. But he landed in the arms of AJ Francis, or as I said when I saw him, hey look, it's the guy from the Treasure Show on A&E. He is apparently part of Swerve's entourage now. He gave Leon Ruff a Death Valley driver onto the barricade, and from there, Swerve finished him off in the ring with the JML driver for the win, a much-needed win for Swerve Scott. And I am all for giving him an entourage, or a new crew, I guess, as he is calling it. And in due time, maybe a slow push towards the North American title, I think would be just what the doctor ordered. Cameron Grimes got a win over the debuting Asher Hell, former Anthony Henry from Evolve. Oh, some of these names. He looks like a slightly more muscular Darby Allin. They did another comedy vignette later in the show with Grimes trying to get into the VIP room at some nightclub to celebrate his win, but the bouncer would not let him in. He said that he was not on the guest list. All of a sudden, a long stretch limousine pulled up, and out came the million-dollar man, Ted DiBiase, who has been tormenting Grimes. He told him, why rent a booth when you can buy the whole club? And then he did his trademark cackle, and he went inside. I do wonder what a 67-year-old Christian minister would be doing in a nightclub on a random Tuesday. I think I watched a Law & Order SVU episode about that once. Tommaso Ciampa and Timothy Thatcher beat the... Let me do it the way that Zach Gibson does it, right? Ciampa and Thatcher beat the grizzled young veterans. Am I the only one who is just greatly annoyed whenever he does that? They do the whole... grizzled young veterans, soon to be, like, shut the fuck up. Seriously. Shut the fuck up. Fucking annoying. It's like he's trying, like, he's so constipated. I feel bad for the guy. He's so constipated. He's trying to get it out, and it just won't. That's why he's got that scowl on his face all the time. Now it makes sense. The guy's trying to go, and nothing's happening. It's going to make you a little cranky. But they beat the grizzled young veterans after Ciampa tossed Wade Barrett's shoe into the ring and Thatcher whacked Gibson with it and then submitted him for the victory. We had a segment with Karrion Kross and Scarlett in the ring. And he made it very clear that Austin Theory is a dead man next week. There was a funny segment in William Regal's office earlier when Gargano had barged in with Theory. And Regal was in the middle of a sit-down meeting with Scarlett. And Theory is just standing there looking down, seemingly at her giant breasts. And the payoff or the punchline to the joke is that he wasn't looking at her breasts. He was commenting on, you know, he was saying, like, look at those. Look how big those are, my God. And he was talking about her giant fingernails. Yeah. Apparently Karrion Kross doesn't buy into that. So they're going to have a non-title match on TV this week. Kyle O'Reilly came out. He was about to challenge Kross when Pete Dunne interrupted. He's the baddest man in NXT. Finn Balor comes down to the ring. A giant brawl breaks out. Gargano and Theory attack Kross from behind. And afterwards, Gargano and Theory, they fled the building like it was April 15th. And Johnny Ace was looking for him. We had Saray in her second match, defeating Zeta Ramir with a Saito suplex. This was stiffer than her first match. Saray was laying her shit in a little more here this week. Ramir has been impressive in her first couple of matches, so the women's division on NXT continues to grow. Don't forget, we haven't seen Frankie Monet in action yet. She keeps popping up backstage in these different segments with her dog. So the women's division continues to grow here, while the divisions on Raw and SmackDown continue to wilt and flounder like a fish every week. But hey, Eva Marie is coming back, right? So all is well. Backstage, Walter was giving his fellow Imperium members a pep talk via Zoom call. It looked like a hostage video, and Walter was reading from that day's newspaper as like a proof of life or something. In German, of course, so I couldn't understand anything he was saying, but he sounded very intimidating doing it. Even on an iPad, he sounded very intimidating. We had a split-screen interview with the NXT Women's Champion Raquel Gonzalez and the number one contender for her title, Mercedes Martinez, ahead of their title match this Tuesday. Martinez said that Gonzalez intimidates the locker room, but not her. You don't see fear in my eyes. And Gonzalez pointed out that in 1 year, she has surpassed all of Mercedes' lifetime achievements. And Martinez said, in one night, I'm taking that title away from you. This is one of two title matches coming up this week. The other has Kushida defending his cruiserweight title against Santos Escobar, 2 out of 3 falls. And in the main event, Candice LeRae and Indy Hartwell beat Ember Moon and Shotzi Blackheart to win the NXT Women's Tag Team titles in a street fight. Lots of plunder, tables, ladders, chairs, oh my. There was a senton off the top rope by Shotzi onto Candice on a ladder bridge outside the ring. Ember gave Indy a fucking brutal Alabama slam into a table that was propped up in the corner that did not break. The back of her head just smacked right into this table. Shotzi, later on, she climbed up onto one of those columns, the truss, whatever you call it, at ringside. She dove off onto Hartwell with a splash through the announce desk. For the finish, there was a springboard flying elbow from Indy Hartwell onto Ember Moon, who was laid out on a table outside the ring, so that took out Ember. And then back inside, Candice gave Shotzi the Wicked Stepsister curb stomp onto a chair and pinned her to win the tag team titles. I thought this was some fun chaos, and I like Candice and Indy together, so I like the title change. I thought, like I said, they opened strong, they ended strong. And at the end of the day, that's really the only thing people are going to remember anyway, so good stuff.
History has been made here!
This week, in wrestling history, we go back 116 years ago this week. By far, the earliest that we've gone back in one of these segments. At Madison Square Garden in New York City, George Hackenschmidt beat Tom Jenkins in 2 straight falls to become the world catch-as-catch-can heavyweight champion, which really was the first recognized world championship in wrestling in this country. This is from an article that appeared the next day in the New York Times. George Hackenschmidt, by his great strength, defeated Tom Jenkins last night for the world's championship at catch-as-catch-can wrestling. At no period during the match, held in the Madison Square Garden, was the American anywhere near securing a fall from the vaunted Russian Lion. Whenever you would hear people say, like in WCW, that the world title traces its roots back to 1905, we used to hear that sometimes. Tony Schiavone would mention it on commentary. It's this match that they are referring to, even though it is greatly stretching the truth to insinuate there being any sort of real lineage between the title that Hackenschmidt won and any modern day title, including the big gold world heavyweight title. Basically, there is none. There is no connection. 37 years ago this week, on May 6th, 1984, World Class Championship Wrestling presented the David Von Erich Memorial Parade of Champions as a tribute to the 25-year-old who died 3 months earlier while on tour with All Japan. David was the one. He was the chosen one. He was the one being groomed to become the NWA World Champion. His father, Fritz, wanted his son to follow in his footsteps. And after David died, Fritz supposedly went to the NWA's Board of Governors and all but pleaded with them to have Ric Flair drop the title to one of his surviving sons instead. They agreed, and the decision was made to put the title on Kerry, who did not have the experience of his older brother Kevin, but he looked the part and he was over with the fans, and so they decided to go with him. And he also was not very reliable, given some of his vices at the time, which is at least part of the reason why he did not hold on to the championship for very long. On this day, before 32,000 fans at Texas Stadium, Kerry pinned Ric Flair with a backslide to become the NWA champion, but he would only hold the title for 18 days. 18 days later, he would drop the belt back to Flair in Japan. He basically got it as a way for the NWA to placate his father, tell this great story of him winning the championship in honor of his late brother. But he would never hold the title again. None of the Von Erich boys would hold the championship ever again. Not that there were many of them left, sadly. 32 years ago this week, on May 7th, 1989, the NWA held its Wrestle War Music City Showdown pay-per-view in Nashville, with Ric Flair pinning Ricky Steamboat in the third and final match of their classic trilogy that year to regain the NWA World's Heavyweight Championship. Judges at ringside to determine the winner, had it gone the full one-hour time limit, were Terry Funk, Pat O'Connor, and Lou Thesz, all former NWA champions themselves. After the match, Funk attacked Flair. After Flair had turned down his request for a title match, and he gave him a pile driver onto a table at ringside. This was voted Match of the Year in 1989 by Pro Wrestling Illustrated, but, you know, with Flair in 89, you pretty much had your pick of the litter. I mean, you could have voted for any of the first two matches with Steamboat, or his I Quit match with Funk at New York Knockout later that year. In a week where Will Ospreay beat Shingo Takagi in a fantastic IWGP title match at the New Japan Pro Wrestling Wrestling Dontaku event, we go back 28 years ago to May 3rd, 1993, the date of the very first Wrestling Dontaku show at the Fukuoka Dome before 55,000 fans. This is back when New Japan had working relationships with both WWE and WCW. Brutus Beefcake beat Masa Saito. Sting wrestled Scott Norton to a double DQ, and in what was billed as a dream match, Hulk Hogan, the reigning WWE champion, beat the great Muta, the reigning IWGP heavyweight champion. Neither championship was on the line. Hogan had his working boots on for this one. He knew what worked in the States and what worked in Japan were two totally different things. Here you saw Hogan doing actual wrestling holds. It was quite jarring to see. And it's also something I mentioned to people, if they ever bring up the fact that, oh, Hogan couldn't work. Hogan couldn't wrestle. No, Hogan could work. If Hogan wanted to work, if he was motivated to work a certain way, depending on where he was and what country he was in, he could work. That is not a valid criticism. Hogan tried to use a chair late in the match. He shoved the referee down when he tried to take it away from him. And when he turned around, Muta misted him, mostly in the chest, not so much in the face. Hogan dropped the big leg, but Muta kicked out. He hit a big boot and his big clothesline finish, which he had used in Japan for years, back in the early 80s. The Axe Bomber for the win. The drama came before and after the match with Hogan's promos. So prior to the match, in fact, I think it was the morning of the match, Hogan was doing an interview, and he said that he was the WWE champion or the WWF champion. But what he really wanted to do was end his career back in Japan, where he had first wrestled years earlier. And in fact, you know, it's worth noting that Hogan was the very first IWGP champion. He won the earliest version of that title back in 1983. He said the IWGP belt was the most important belt in the world today. Now, he said this while having the Winged Eagle belt draped over his shoulder. And then he said that the WWF title was just a stepping stone and that he wants the IWGP belt. Fast forward later on, after his win over Muda, in the post-match media session, he's sitting at the dais, Jimmy Hart is with him, he's trying to sit the WWF belt on the table without it falling down. And Hogan is talking to the media, and he's pointing at the belt, and he calls it a toy. He calls it a trinket, like an ornament on a Christmas tree, he says. He says the belt that he wants is the one with the great Muda, the one that Muda has, because he wants all of the great wrestlers to come to him. He wants them to come to Japan where he can wrestle and not bullshit. I want to wrestle and prove that I'm the best. As you would imagine, this did not go over very well back in the States, although Hogan, you know, back then it would be rare for anyone to go over on Hogan. But people in WWE were not very happy about him burying their championship, which is what he did. He buried the belt. Hogan claimed he was either misquoted or his comments were taken out of context, I forget which. Which might have worked if there was an actual video footage of him speaking those exact words on camera in plain English. 2 days later, at Kawasaki Stadium in Japan, FMW hosted its fourth anniversary show with an explosive main event. Literally. It was the Atsushi Onita against Terry Funk match that is talked about by a lot of people to this very day. The very first no ropes barbed wire time bomb death match. So they'd already done no ropes barbed wire matches before, but never a match where the ring would explode at the very end. The event was a huge success off the back of that match. They drew 41,000 people, 32,000 of those paid for a $1.8 million gate. The referee, it's just comical. The referee was wearing what can only be best described as it may have been an actual beekeeper's outfit, for all I know, because this guy wasn't taking any chances, okay? When the referee is wearing protective padding, you know some shit's about to go down. But this was a case of the teacher and the student. Funk had trained Onita in Amarillo years earlier. Each time one of them touched the barbed wire, there would be a small explosion. After 10 minutes, there was a 5-minute countdown clock before the ring would supposedly blow up. Onita won the match with a DDT with about 2.5 minutes left before the big kaboom. And there was a loud air raid siren playing as time ticked away. Onita exited the ring with about 20 seconds left. Then he realized how little time was left. And he looked back and he saw Terry Funk, his teacher, his mentor in many ways, laying there in the ring. And ever the heroic babyface, Onita scurried back inside. He started smacking him in the face. He's trying to wake him up. He's trying to drag him out of the ring. But with 3 seconds left, he realizes there's no time. He lays on top of Funk to protect him as explosions went off around the ring. Funk's nose was all cut up from the barbed wire. Onita needed 72 stitches in his back and his stomach when it was over. This was the inspiration for the Jon Moxley-Kenny Omega match that we got earlier this year at Revolution. The final explosion here was, you know, better than the sparklers that we got on the AEW show, but not by much. This was the first time anybody had ever tried something like this, though, so you leave some margin for error, I guess. It was the emotion of the match and the epic selling by Terry Funk, his facial expressions, the way he sold pain every time he would hit the barbed wire. That's really what makes this match stand out as a classic. Onita actually announced this week that FMW is coming back as FMWE, the E standing for Explosion. It is now in the name of the promotion. They're holding their first show on July 4th at some fruit and vegetable market in Japan. Come buy a mango and stay for the explosions. But apparently that's going to be the new draw, or the draw of this new promotion, is that every main event or every big main event is going to be an exploding barbed wire death match. 27 years ago, on May 7th, 1994, we go back to Japan, this time for a WWE show in Yokohama that saw WWE champion Bret the Hitman Hart not only kick out of a Randy Savage elbow, but submit the Macho Man with the sharpshooter in the main event. It's too bad we never got that match at a pay-per-view here in the States. 2 days later, in Osaka, featured an 18-man Royal Rumble match, which was a 45-minute affair that ended with The Undertaker eliminating Bam Bam Bigelow for the win. Undertaker was still off WWF television during this time. He would not reappear until SummerSlam. The real Undertaker, not the imposter one. Earlier on the card, Undertaker beat Jinsei Shinzaki in a one-on-one match, who would join the company the following year as Hakushi. This was one of three Royal Rumble matches that WWE did in 94. There was also one at Madison Square Garden in January, less than a week before the pay-per-view version, which Owen Hart won. It was a long match. It went about an hour and 10 minutes with Owen going over. I know there is, or at least there used to be, fan cam footage of that one available online. I'm sure if you search around for it, it's still probably floating around somewhere. 23 years ago this week, on May 3rd, 1998, at a WWE live event in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, Edge and Christian had their first singles match against one another in the company, but not as Edge and Christian. Instead, it was as Adam Copeland and Christian Cage, and it was a win for Edge. This was Christian's very first WWE match. Edge had put in a good word for him and got him invited to Dory Funk Jr.'s Funking Conservatory training camp that year, which at the time had an affiliation with WWE. And from there, he got signed to a contract. He didn't make his television debut until September at the Breakdown In Your House pay-per-view. Edge made his in-ring television debut about 7 weeks after this match against Jose Estrada of Los Boricuas, in a match where Edge landed on Estrada's, on his head, really, on a suicide senton out over the top rope, and he broke Estrada's neck in the process. Edge's leg came right down on top of Estrada's head. It's kind of weird how his career began with a broken neck and ended 10 years ago with a broken neck of his own. But now he's back. Estrada did wrestle again, but not for WWE, and he never really did much after that. On that very same night, in 98, ECW hosted WrestlePalooza on pay-per-view, the only WrestlePalooza of the four they ever did to air on pay-per-view, emanating from Marietta, Georgia, and it was not a great show. Rob Van Dam fought Sabu to a 30-minute time limit draw for the television title, and Shane Douglas retained his ECW World Heavyweight title in the main event over Al Snow. Douglas suffered an injury. He was out of action for a few months after this, which is why Taz was given an old TV title that he branded the FTW title to defend until Douglas was ready to come back. Brian Cage now holds that FTW title in AEW. This was also Al Snow's final ECW match before returning to WWE, who had sent him to ECW after the new rocker stuff that he was doing with Marty Jannetty. Didn't exactly light the world on fire, but they knew there was something there. They liked the guy. They knew he had talent. They just needed him to just find himself and find a way to bring that personality out of him. And they thought Heyman might be just the person to try to do that. So They had something of a secret little working relationship at the time with ECW, and he wound up going there. And what ended up happening was he got over. Wouldn't you know, he started doing the head gimmick, and the moment the WWE saw how over he was, they called him back up. During the show, Joey Styles introduced a celebration of Georgia legends. Among them were Dirty Dick Slater, Bullet Bob Armstrong, the Masked Superstar, Bill Eadie, a.k.a. Demolition Axe, and the Junkyard Dog, who was once a massive star for Bill Watts in the Mid-South Territory. In fact, that was his most most prosperous period in wrestling. Even more than the stuff he did in WWE, Junkyard Dog was a huge star. Made a lot of money in Mid-South. And then he went to WWE, and his weight got the better of him, and he was never the same performer ever again. He was the most over star of the bunch here when he was introduced. Loud chants of JYD. But there is a funny story behind this. There was a physical confrontation, an altercation, if you will, in the back before he came out with New Jack. And as New Jack tells the story to Sean Oliver, he had sold some weed to Jay. Now, you know when a story starts like that, it's going down a bad road. When you're talking about New Jack here and a deal gone sideways, but he had sold some weed to JYD sometime before. I mean, it may have been months before this. And he never got paid. And later on, there was some kind of barbecue at another wrestler's house, and he found out that somebody had Junkyard Dog on the phone. He goes, give me the phone. I want to talk to him. He gets on the phone with him, and he says, you owe me $300 for the weed that I got you. And he claims that Junkyard Dog told him that he wasn't going to pay him anything. And New Jack is not the kind of person that you want to owe money to. He's like, motherfucker, I'm going to get my money. So now fast forward to this show, and New Jack finds out that JYD is going to be there. And Paul Heyman finds out about this beef, and he desperately does not want him to do anything to ruin the show. And he tells New Jack, look, I'll pay you myself. I'll pay you for the weed. How much does he owe you? And New Jack says, $300. And Heyman says, I'll cut you a check myself for the $300. Now, if Paul Heyman promises to cut you a check, that's enough reason. At least back then, that's enough reason to say no. But New Jack says no because you don't owe me the money. He wants Dog to pay him because he's the one who owes him the money, not Paul Heyman. He goes, he's going to pay me my $300. So he sees Junkyard Dog backstage, and there are differing stories about whether or not JYD was bragging about the fact that I'm not going to pay this guy. Oh, you didn't think I was going to show up, did you? I don't know who said what, but New Jack says he was wearing a pinky ring and he slugged JYD with it right in the face. He cut him. He said he cut him right under Dog's eye. He was bleeding all over his shirt and he had to change shirts before he came out to the ring for the big ceremony here. In fact, if you go back and watch it, and miraculously Peacock has it up right now, JYD is introduced wearing an ECFNW t-shirt, which they had to give him. I'm sure they gave it to him to replace his own bloody shirt. I mean, if what New Jack is saying is true, it would make sense. If he had blood all over his shirt, he took the shirt off, ECW, you know, gave him one of their own shirts. He was the only legend they brought out who was wearing an ECW shirt. And his eye looks fine, but he's got what looks like a piece of, I don't know, tissue or toilet paper or something right next to his mouth, like right by his lip. And it's got a little bit of blood on it. It's almost like if you cut yourself while you're shaving, that's what it looked like. And it was only a month later, JYD was driving home from his daughter's high school graduation when they believe he fell asleep at the wheel and he rolled his car 3 times and died. New Jack is still upset that he never got his $300, that he died before he could get it. 19 years ago this week, on May 5th, 2002, Cinco de Mayo, The day that WWE got the F out and the World Wrestling Federation officially changed over to World Wrestling Entertainment. The World Wildlife Fund predated the World Wrestling Federation. The World Wildlife Fund was founded in 1961. In 1963, Vince McMahon Sr. and Toots Mont, still one of the greatest names, they split from the NWA and created the Worldwide Wrestling Federation. In 1979, they shortened the name to WWF, and in the years that follow, the two groups coexisted with the same initials until 1994, when they reached an agreement on how McMahon would use the WWF initials. Now, why it took until 1994, I don't know. My guess would be the Panda people had already filed suit against them over the name many years earlier, or they threatened to. But anyway, they reached an understanding that Titan Sports, which was the parent company of WWF at the time, would stop using those initials and do everything in their power to not speak the initials verbally on TV. I guess they were okay with them verbally saying World Wrestling Federation because then there could be no confusion in the marketplace about what they were talking about. I guess they were worried if Vince McMahon went on TV and said WWF, people would be confused and think they were watching whales and walruses fucking or something. I don't know. The wildlife folks, in turn, agreed not to sue them or to make them change their logo. Now, obviously, Vince McMahon kept saying WWF on television. He said it all the time. For many more years, he completely ignored their agreement. Fast forward to the year 2000. The Panda people filed suit against the WWF in a UK court, claiming unfair trade practices and alleging that they violated their earlier agreement. In 2001, the court ruled in favor of the Wildlife Fund, and WWF filed an appeal in October of that year. That appeal was still pending when, in May of 2002, the WWF decided to drop the appeal and just go through with changing its name. And very quietly overnight, they changed the website from WWF.com to WWE.com. All references were changed. I remember it like it was yesterday. It was such a quick, sudden change. Clearly, they had decided sometime earlier to give in and just make the change. My understanding has always been that the UK court ruling only applied to international use of the initials, so WWF could continue to market themselves as the World Wrestling Federation here in the States, but everywhere else in the world, they wouldn't be able to do that. Now, obviously, it would be confusing to call yourself one name here and another name somewhere else, and, you know, they're a global company, and they just said, the hell with it, we'll just change the name. Now, that didn't end things between the two sides. The Panda people tried to get hundreds of millions of damages. That got shot down. WWE claimed the wildlife people were trying to extort them. And, you know, look, that may be so, but it's pretty clear that the Wildlife Fund had the initials first and Titan violated the agreement from 94. I mean, it's pretty cut and dry. Years later, ahead of the WWE Network launch, the two sides reached an agreement that allowed for them to not have to blur out every Attitude Scratch logo and mute every verbal reference to WWF. You know, as a fan, that was the biggest issue for me, were the blurs. This company plasters its logo on everything. So you would be watching past footage and you would think you had cataracts in your eyes. There were so many blurs on the screen. And I know it was just a change in name only, but it still feels like two distinctly different eras to me. You have the WWF era, and you have the WWE era. And it just feels like two completely different things. But I do think it's appropriate the last person to ever hold the WWF title with those initials and be recognized as the WWF champion was Hulk Hogan. The next day, on May 6th, 2002, was the infamous plane ride from hell, which is getting a Dark Side of the Ring episode this season, here in Season 3. When you have an entire Dark Side of the Ring episode devoted to a flight, that either means one of two things. Either that plane went down and everybody died, or something really bad happened on that plane. And they interviewed some of the flight crew for it, apparently. So that should be a good episode when it airs later this season. Now, Kurt Angle told a story recently on his podcast about Vince McMahon trying to wrestle him on the plane. Vince McMahon was not even on this flight. Kurt Angle is conflating this with a different flight that came before this. I mean, even Sean Waltman talked about Vince and Kurt having a little takedown tournament in the aisle of a plane when he was talking about how hypocritical he thought it was for Kurt Hennig to get in trouble for doing the same thing on this flight with Brock Lesnar. Same thing that Vince did with Kurt. Believe me, if Vince McMahon had been on that plane, a lot of the stuff that went down here would never have happened. But when the boss is away, the children will play. This was a 7-hour flight home from the Insurrection pay-per-view in the UK where the wrestlers got all drunk and all stupid. They were headed home for Raw that night in Hartford, Connecticut. It was a chartered flight, which meant that they had the whole plane to themselves. And according to Justin Credible, who was on the plane, it also came with an open bar, which is a recipe for disaster. Sean Waltman was there. He said some guys were drinking, other guys were doing GHB and getting all pilled up. Kurt Hennig kept razzing Brock Lesnar about who the better amateur wrestler was. You know, two Minnesota boys, they were friends, but they were going at it so hard at one point that people were worried they might knock the emergency door open at 35,000 feet in the air, and then they would all plummet to their deaths. They had to be separated by Triple H, Paul Heyman, and Fit Finlay. Hennig was fired over the incident, and that was it for him and the company. He was dead, you know, less than a year later. And Brock Lesnar a few years ago told Dan Le Batard that he doesn't remember much about the flight because he was drunk and high. Then you have Ric Flair walking around in nothing but his robe, balls naked, strutting down the aisle. Woo! Two flight attendants later sued the company. They alleged that Flair was spinning his penis around and he grabbed their hands and placed them on his junk. And then he forcibly detained and restrained one of them from leaving the back of the plane and he sexually assaulted her. Flair denied the allegation, said there was no truth to any of it. WWE eventually settled out of court with both women, who also claimed that other wrestlers on the flight passed out syringes to them, asking them to throw them away for them. Dustin Rhodes was on the flight drunk and serenading his ex-wife Terry over the loudspeaker to the point where she was very uncomfortable, and Jim Ross had to ask him to stop. Michael Hayes, producer with the company at the time, right? He was one of the few people on the flight you could say was in a position of authority. He got into a fight with Bradshaw, which then led to Sean Waltman cutting off. This is great. When Hayes eventually fell asleep, Waltman cut off his ponytail while he was sleeping. The next day at TV, he says he nailed it to the wall and he auctioned it off. Maybe they auctioned it off for charity. I can just picture Hayes walking in and there it is. There's his hair. Nailed up to the wall. Scott Hall was a mess, according to Justin Credible, and he had to wheel him through the airport in a wheelchair after. And as he's doing this, he sees Jim Ross, who's sitting there with his luggage, and Jim Ross looks up and sees him wheeling Hall, who's like a dead body, and he just shakes his head. JR just can do nothing but sit there and shake his head. Even though Ross claimed that Scott Hall behaved on the flight, because there were a lot of other allegations levied against Scott Hall, Jim Ross has said, no, he was behaving himself on the plane, but yet he was also fired. Doesn't sound like the sort of thing you would do to a guy who was behaving himself. Now, in his Ross Report column on WWE.com, JR, who was also the head of talent relations at the time, had this to say. Said the flight was low-lighted by a handful of people who consumed too much alcohol. Well, don't forget the pills. Too much alcohol and consequently acted like children whose parents were away and left the liquor cabinet unlocked. The conduct of this inebriated minority was unacceptable and will not be tolerated. Procedures have been put in place to ensure that such conduct does not occur in the future. The bottom line is this. Yours truly is the person in charge of the talent roster, and the buck stops with me. To this day, there is no alcohol served on any of the WWE charter flights. 19 years ago this week, on May 8th, 2002, the first press release was sent announcing the debut of a new promotion called NWA Total Nonstop Action Wrestling, which started out as a weekly Wednesday night pay-per-view series and would later evolve into TNA Impact Wrestling. The release had Dixie Carter listed as the PR contact, which is what she did prior to her involvement in wrestling. She ran her own public relations firm. The release stated that the premiere date would be June 19th and would feature nationally and world-renowned superstars from the National Wrestling Alliance, the oldest professional wrestling sanctioning body in the world. Appearing on initial programs will be top names such as former world champion Jeff Jarrett, former UFC champion Ken Shamrock, NWA legends Dory Funk Jr. and Harley Race, hardcore midget Puppet, Puerto Rican sensation Apollo, and young high flyer AJ Styles. These top athletes, representing a diverse array of wrestling styles, will be joined by the luscious TNA girls, as well as other top free agent wrestlers from around the world who will be announced in the weeks to come. In addition, superstars from both the entertainment and sporting worlds, as well as infamous celebrities, will make guest appearances on a regular basis to create this new multifaceted approach to wrestling entertainment. The first broadcast will feature country music superstar Toby Keith and current NASCAR Winston Cup point leader Sterling Marlin. Interesting to see Toby Keith's name attached so early, because in 2014, Bob Carter, Dixie's daddy, was done bleeding money on this thing. He had poured so much of his own money into this company. It was like a money pit. And he was pretty much at the end of his rope. He was looking to sell the company. Toby Keith came very close to buying TNA at that time. Jim Ross even says that Keith came to him and wanted him involved in running the business. But what killed the whole deal was Bob Carter saying that any sale would be contingent on Keith keeping his daughter Dixie on board with her existing title, that she would retain some power within the company and stay on as a television character. And Toby Keith rightfully told him, I mean in so many words, to fuck off. He wasn't going to buy into a company unless it was completely his, with no strings attached. I mean, I was appalled reading that the first time 7 years ago, and I'm just as appalled, you know, reading that today, that he would even have the gall to make such a request. 14 years ago this week, on May 8th, 2007, at the SmackDown tapings in Pittsburgh, The Undertaker, torn biceps and all, wrestled to a draw in a steel cage match against Batista for the World Heavyweight title when both men climbed down the cage and hit the floor at the same time. Or actually, not at the same time. Was it the same time? I'm not sure now. If it was either at the same time or they determined that Undertaker maybe hit the ground before him. I'm almost positive it was a draw. Anyway, Undertaker retained the title. Mark Henry came out to attack Undertaker, left him laying, and then came Edge, ever the opportunist, to cash in the second Money in the Bank briefcase of his career. This is the one that he had taken on Raw, I think that week, from Mr. Kennedy, who had won it at WrestleMania and then got hurt, and they thought he was seriously hurt, so they had to get the briefcase off of him, which they really didn't. He had a full year to cash in. In fact, Kennedy had already been teasing that he was going to wait until WrestleMania the following year. So I don't understand what the whole rush was to get the fucking briefcase off of him, but they did, and unfortunately for him, it turned out that his arm injury was not as serious as originally believed. I think it was like a deep bone bruise, and he was back within a few weeks, so this poor fucker lost his briefcase. Edge got it, and then Edge came out here to cash it in. He pinned The Undertaker, he won the big gold belt, and officially became part of the SmackDown brand, a brand that he made his own. Edge carried SmackDown during those years. The best thing that could have happened to him was getting away from John Cena, and more importantly, getting away from Triple H on Monday Night Raw. And finally, 10 years ago this week, on May 3rd, 2011, at the first SmackDown taping after the Extreme Rules pay-per-view, Christian defended his newly won World Heavyweight Championship title that many, myself included, never thought he would have. But when his best friend Edge was forced to relinquish the title and retire due to injury, Christian got the nod and he got his moment. He beat Alberto Del Dipshit in a ladder match at Extreme Rules. Edge was there. It was this big emotional moment that turned into a nightmare just 48 hours later. Christian came out. He said he waited 17 years to have this moment. Mark Henry came out. He wanted to be the first challenger, the Great Khali, and Randy Orton. Randy Orton came out as well, and the fans wanted Orton, and so Teddy Long made the match for that night. It would be Christian defending his new title against Randy Orton. And the two went on to have a great match that ended with Orton catching Christian in midair in a springboard off the ropes into an RKO to win the title and end Christian's first world title run at just 2 days, which WWE acknowledges as 5 days because this show did not air until that Friday. But it was only 2 days. People were very angry. I remember ranting about it on the podcast. My buddy Noah was at the tapings, and he was the one who first texted me to tell me that Orton had won the title, and I didn't even believe him. I thought he was just being silly. Only to find out that, nope, they really did take the title off Christian. And I said at the time, you know, if nothing else, if you want to look at the bright side of this, this should keep Christian in the main event mix for at least the next month. And it turned out he got 3 months out of it. What we got out of it was the best WWE feud, in my opinion, of the year. You know, some people might say Cena and Punk. You know, the match they had at Money in the Bank that year, which Orton and Christian had a match on that show as well. In fact, that Money in the Bank show is where Christian won the belt back. Randy Orton got himself disqualified. And I think Christian won the championship on that show. Cena and Punk at Money in the Bank, though, was just magic in a different way. You know, in front of that Chicago crowd. Probably the match of the year that year for the company. But the Orton-Christian feud, the Orton-Christian program, their rivalry, in my opinion, if it wasn't number one, then it was number two. It was absolutely one of the best things in that company all year. Every time those two stepped in the ring together, they had great matches. And that is this week in wrestling history. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. If you have questions, you can always email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. As I mentioned before, I will save the Brian Pillman Dark Side of the Ring review for a separate video on YouTube. I might take the audio after that and push it out to the feed. We'll see how long it is. I haven't recorded it yet, but hopefully that should be going up in the next day or two. There was just so much stuff this week and so many documentaries and just... it's wrestling, so of course there's always a gazillion things going on. But I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope that all the moms out there are having, or if you're listening to this late, have had a happy Mother's Day. I'm going to be back with you next Sunday for episode 704 of the podcast. First, though, I will be live on YouTube this Wednesday talking AEW Dynamite, which is a pretty stacked card on paper. Should be a good show. I'm looking forward to that. And if you want to become a channel member on YouTube, you may do so. Any video, or even if you go to the main page on the channel, you'll see the join button. We have crossed the 100 member threshold, which was an important goal that I had set for myself. You know, memberships have only been open for about a month, so I was very happy to cross that goal, and now we have a new one, and I can only climb and reach that goal with your support. So if you want to go check out what perks are involved there and what you get for either membership tier, just head on over to the Solomonster Sounds of YouTube channel. And that's all I got. So until next time, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. We'll do it all over again next Sunday. How about that? Sound good? I'll see you for 704. Take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
The great Khali. When I think back to all those Khali moments, I mean, we've got the, well, you know, there was the time that he, who can forget that great, you know, How about I just share a story? Big Show sees Kali walk in. He says, "Hey, motherfucker, why do you keep stealing my spots? That's bullshit. You can't even do any of it properly anyway because you're the fucking shits."
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.